South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very good Saturday morning. Beautiful morning across South Texas and the Hill Country, wherever you happen to be listening. Looks like it's going to be a great weekend for gardening. They keep promising us rain, but then they just keep lowering the chances lower and lower and lower. So maybe tomorrow, but today, golly, there's a lot of things to do and a lot of things you need to do. And what fun it'll be to get out and get them done. You know, the most important thing to me is what is on your mind. There's one open line, so grab it if you like, 210-599-5555. And first three callers are going to be Kathy, Mark, and Janice. Let's just go ahead and get started with phone calls. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Oh, off to a good start. It's dark and early, as we say. Saturday morning is just too darn early, the hour I have to get up, but it's always fun talking with good people. So how can I help you today?
Oh, okay. Thank you. Actually, I'm interested in planting some crepe myrtles, and my favorite color of the crepe myrtles is a very soft pink, and I thought that when I looked at them probably 10 years ago that the soft pink one, that it was a variety that didn't grow real tall. It was kind of like a sort of a dwarf crepe myrtle. Is that true?
Oh, there are so many of them out there. The one that you, golly, I'll have to think for a second about which one. Probably the one you're thinking of is called Tuscarora. And that's kind of a soft pink, kind of a medium height crepe myrtle. It'll get up to that 10 to 12 foot range. But the biggest and the one most people think of when they think of soft pink is one called Basham's Party Pink. But that one will grow 35 feet tall. So I think Tuscarora is probably the one you're thinking of. And it's going to be medium height. It's definitely not one of the dwarfs, but it is a pretty crepe myrtle.
Okay. And is that a common one that I can find?
I don't think you'd have any trouble finding it. Probably the nursery in San Antonio that has the most crepe myrtles would be Fanix. You might call over there and talk to either Mark or Mike, and they'll let you know what they have in stock.
Okay. And is there a dwarf crepe myrtle?
Though there are many, many dwarf crepe myrtles. Soft pink, I don't really have a soft pink dwarf that comes to mind, but I know that there certainly are some. There's a pretty kind of a more of a reddish pink out there, which is called Poco Moki. That might be one you'd like to take a look at. It's P-O-C-O, Poco M-O-C-E-E, I believe. And that one it's one of the prettiest ones out there, and it's also one that just stays very low and compact, stays down in the 4 to 5 foot range, but golly, it can cover itself with flowers to the point where you hardly even see the plant for all the flowers.
Okay, thank you. And then I was wondering, I'm interested in knowing whether or not I could grow a avocado tree in a pot that's probably 3 feet tall only about a foot wide.
You certainly could, at least for a while. The avocados stay fairly compact, and you're going to be getting it in probably a 5-gallon container, which would fit down very well into that pot. You, of course, would want to fill the pot with good soil underneath, be sure it has a hole in the bottom, and then add enough soil that when you put your crepe myrtle in, it's going to be up to within about an inch or so of the top. But when you put your avocado in, and that's probably going to hold you for about 3 years. Ultimately, avocados do make a tree, and obviously that's not going to be big enough for something that really gets big, big tree-like, but it'll serve you for several years.
Okay. And then last week you were talking about how you can add DT in a syringe to the stalks of zucchini plants.
Right, to stop the squash vine borers.
Right. Do you have a paper on that at your store?
I don't know that we have done one of those yet. That sounds like one we should do, but I'm not sure that we have one of those written out on that use of BT. But okay. There's really nothing to it. Again, I make it a little bit more concentrated, put maybe a tablespoon or two of BT and about a cup of water, and then that's what I'll inject into the stems. A little bit more concentrated than we would use if we were spraying, but still goes real easily. And I would use some people use a turkey baster that aren't comfortable with the syringe. I don't mind syringes. I grew up in the biology lab doing all kinds of injections. So it's about the same gauge needle that a doctor would use for penicillin, a fairly large needle, but it sure makes it easy. Now, like as you've probably heard me say, zucchini has a much more solid stem than your crookneck squash do. So rather than just be able to stick it in one place and squirt it up and down the stem, I find you have to usually inject it four or five places, but it sure does stop the vine borers.
Okay. And how often do you do that? Just when you see those fibers?
I usually just once a season.
Okay.
I like to do it when the vines are maybe 18 inches long and, you know, start about 4 or 5 inches above the ground, because that's where that moth usually lays the egg. But don't let it get too terribly big, maybe 14, 16, 18 inches, somewhere in there, where you have 3 or 4 places to inject it. And, of course, the way squash grows, that's it's not going to be a real old plant when you inject it, because they're just getting started. Now, if you do in the bush form of zucchini, then I would probably, golly, as soon as that stem is 6 inches long, I'd be injecting it. But if you're doing the regular vining zucchini, let it get just a little bit larger.
Okay. Thank you. And do I do any other, are there any other plants that I should do like that, like squash maybe?
No. Squash are about the only one that gets the vine borer, and not all squash do. The squash with real slender stems, like most of your long season squashes, and that little one they call calabacita, that one is kind of like a little round zucchini. And unless a squash has a fairly big stem, that borer larvae can't get into it, because it's a pretty fat little grub that it forms. So the squash that have a narrow stem, and related things like cucumbers and melons and things, most of those stems are just too small in diameter for the vine borer to get in there. So really the crooknecks, the patty pans, the zucchinis, those are about the only ones you really have to worry about injecting.
Okay. And then I have one more question. I had purchased some cantaloupe and some spaghetti squash transplants. And so I was planting them, and I was reading about them online, and it said that those don't usually do well from transplants.
They do fine from transplants. Yeah, there's no problem. They'll do just fine.
Okay, great.
About the only things I don't recommend from transplants in warm season vegetables, I don't think that beans really ever do very well as transplants. And on things like okra, they do fine as transplants, but when you can buy a whole pack of seeds for the cost of one transplant, if you have room to plant any number of them, I just recommend planting from seed. But with the squash and cucumbers and things like that, if you want to plant them from transplants, that's just fine. Your long season squashes, you do need to get those in the ground, because they take about 3 times as long to produce as zucchinis and crooknecks and things do, but shouldn't be any problem at all planting those from transplants. Your melons and squash and cucumbers, all those are just fine.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you for the call, and you have a wonderful weekend as well, and we'll move along and talk to Mark next. Good morning, Mark. Is Mark there, Don? Okay, then...
You didn't mean Morris by any chance.
I'm sorry?
You didn't mean Morris by any chance, did you?
Oh, okay. I think we just got a name mixed up there. Good morning. How can I help you?
Well, I seem to have a recalcitrant fire ant mound, and I've been using the Come and Get It, which, you know, it's not a brand new fresh bag, but it's not old, and it's always been stored in the house. So I guess maybe I'm going to have to resort to the drench, but I can't remember the mixture for that.
Well, with drenching the mound, the easiest thing to use is orange oil, and I would put about two or three tablespoons of orange oil to a gallon of water, and then just, you know, soak that mound as thoroughly as you can. It kills the ants within minutes, and you know, if you, I usually do a full watering can, which is usually about a gallon and a half, and I rarely ever have to treat a mound the second time.
Okay, I had just forgotten. I went to the dirt doctor. It didn't seem to have the recipe that I remembered.
Sure.
But how long, shouldn't that fertilizer would come and get it last in the house for quite a while, if you know, stored in the house?
I would expect it to last for at least a year. The other thing that can, you know, affect the effectiveness of it is, you know, you want to put it out when the ants are active, either early morning or evening. And you don't ever want to disturb the mound when you put it out, because the ants, you want the ants to find it and take it down. And those, and you know, with the weather, sometimes it's hard to know exactly when, but you want to put it out at the time that you see the ants coming and going. And other than that, no, it should absolutely last, I would say, for at least a year or two under the conditions. You know how to store things, so you're doing it right.
Well, since it's early morning, maybe I'll go down and give them a dose right now and see what happens.
Give them a dose right now and wait till this afternoon. Give them a chance to pick it up and then, you know, drench that mound. And as the exterminators say, everybody dies.
Right. Well, okay. Well, that's what I need to know. Thank you very much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the call this morning. Next in line is Janice. Good morning, Janice.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have several questions. One is about Greg's mist flower, the plant.
Mm-hmm.
I planted it probably about 2 years ago and babied it along, and then this spring it has just come up gangbusters. And I have a bed that's about 15 feet by 3 feet along the side of the driveway, and it's just totally filled with that plant, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Which the butterflies love you for.
You know, I was trying to encourage the butterflies.
Right.
Anyway, since I've never had it grow, you know, to this extent, does it bloom all summer long?
Yes, it does. Yes, it blooms almost constantly, and it almost becomes a weed. I'm surprised you had a little trouble getting it started the first time, because it's normally one of those things that just tries to take over, and it sounds like yours, once it got its feet down, so to speak, it is very controllable. You can cut it back pretty much as you like, and since you have a big bed of it, if you find it necessary to cut it back, just do it half of the bed at a time. Leave half of it for the butterflies, cut the other half back, and then once that comes out and starts blooming again, then you can cut the first half back if it's really getting out of hand. If it's confined in a bed, you probably don't really have to do anything unless it just acts like it wants to take over your whole yard.
Well, it really can't go anywhere, so
okay,
it's in the perfect spot. I just wanted to make sure it was going to bloom all summer, and I guess
putting a
little fertilizer on it's not going to hurt any.
That's what will keep it blooming. I would use, for fastest results, one of the liquid fertilizers like Medina's Has to Grow or the Liquid Fish Blend. I don't think you need to go quite as strong as their new Super Grow Has to Grow, but I'd just use the Has to Grow plant. And you've said every 3 weeks or so.
I've got it by the bag here. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that answers that. Now, this year I have, I guess I would call it a weed, although it's not an ugly plant. The little clover plants.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the right word to use, but it grows in little clumps. It's little three-leaf clovers. And then if you let it go, it'll start forming little seed pods.
Little burr-like seed pods?
No, it's just like little pea pods.
Okay. Though that is probably an oxalis, but they're closely related to clovers.
Okay. Well, where could this thing have come from? It's all over my front yard, and I have never had it, and it's growing now all over. And the only thing I can imagine is that the only new ingredient that I've put out in my yard is I've put a whole bag of the ground cornmeal under my oats. And could that have been a seed that was mixed in with the ground cornmeal?
No, probably not. Is yours the one that has the yellow flower, or what color is the flower on this oxalis?
I want to say it's a little yellow one.
Yeah, yeah. Those seeds could have been lying there in the soil for 20 years, and just this was the year that the conditions were ripe for them to sprout and grow. There are more little weedy plants in that group. I've seen more this year than I think I've ever seen, and apparently just the combination, the cold came at the right time, the rains came at the right time, and be thankful you don't have the other one that I was afraid you were going to describe, which is what we call burr clover, that makes a real, it's not like a sticker burr, it's not something that's going to stick you and really hurt you, but boy, if you have pets, let me tell you, you'll be brushing them daily to get them out, to get the burrs out. So oxalis isn't as bad as some of the others, and it's actually helping your soil. Oxalis, like clover, will grow in soils that are very hard-packed, where most other weeds don't really grow well, and it's actually Mother Nature's way of softening the soil. We just think of it as a weed because it's different from what we typically plant as a lawn grass. So it tends to, well, and it, let me ask, is yours the... Is it fairly compact? It only gets maybe an inch or two tall and makes a little clump maybe 3 inches wide?
No, this is stuff that's growing about 6 or 7 inches tall,
okay.
Maybe even a little bit taller, and about a foot across almost.
And what is your basic grass that you have in that area?
I don't have any grass. I just have oak tree leaves and, you know, assorted mulch.
Okay. Well, if you want to get rid of it, you can spray it with vinegar and orange oil. That won't hurt your oak trees and all, but it's not hurting anything. And I typically tell people, especially if it's growing in grass, just mow it off. It's going to recede. It's not going to go away as quickly as some of the other things will, but as the weather gets hot, you will see less of it. But if it's something you'd rather not have, the vinegar and orange oil will take care of it easily and very safely.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to go to the trouble of spraying it. It's actually in a bed that's got Wedelia and I want to say Aurelia, but that's not right. There's another short ground cover. It starts with an A. Ardesia.
Ardesia. Okay. Yeah. Related to coffee, of all things.
But, is it really? It's got a little red berry on it in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. It's pretty.
I've never tried to do anything with that berry, but... it is. You don't see it much in this part of the country. I used to see it up in Dallas fairly regularly, but it's a pretty shiny-leaved little plant, so you're doing well.
Yeah, it's been there 20 years. It's very spread very little, though.
Mm-hmm.
But it's doing its job, keeping a few things green underneath the oaks. All right.
Other than the oak sprouts. Okay, go ahead.
That's just it. The trees I have in my front yard do put out a lot of oak sprouts, no matter how much mulch and stuff I put down to keep the soil dark. But the Ardesia grows about the same height as the oak sprouts, so they're hidden in there. Anyway,
that's perfect. That's perfect.
My last question is macho ferns. Now, for several years, I had beautiful macho ferns I hung up in the trees with fronds about, you know, almost 3 feet long. And then, of course, I didn't do a very good job of taking them down and covering them, so they've died the last couple of years, so they're not coming back. So I bought some new ones, but I can't find any that have the long, arching, you know, fronds coming out. And is that a product of it not getting enough light or too much light? I mean, how can I get those long fronds to grow?
Well, be sure you've got macho ferns to begin with. The macho fern is a kind of a Boston fern. Botanically, they're called Nephrolepis, and there are probably 100 different varieties, from Kimberly Queen to Fluffy Ruffles to Compacta. The macho is just the you know, the biggest probably member of that family. If it's not getting as big as you've experienced in the past, either you didn't get a true macho fern or you're not feeding it enough. Like all ferns, they're happiest if they get sun in the morning, shade in the afternoon. But if this is in a place where they've done well before, there's no reason they shouldn't be doing well now. So,
maybe I just need to fertilize them more?
That's where I would start. Macho ferns are usually one of the latest ones to show up. We just started getting macho ferns probably a week ago, where we've been getting Kimberly Queen ferns for 3 months. So hopefully what you got is truly a macho fern. But they don't really get those big, long fronds until they're fairly well established. So I would fertilize it and give it a little time and see what it does. It may turn into what you're hoping for. I think it probably will.
All right. Well, it looks a lot better hanging up there on that basket if it's got a frond that's hanging down.
Well, they are spectacular when they really get going. The thing that happens with this whole group of ferns, all the Boston ferns, is given 2 or 3 years, they always start as a clump and they grow outwards, and then that
right.
center of the clump starts to die back. So usually
right.
about every 3 or 4 years, you have to take that basket down, take the fern out, and chop it into about 4 pieces and move each one, you know, put it in 4 different
right.
baskets and move one back to the center. That's just the little nuisance you put up with when you want to grow that type of ferns. But I can't really think of anything that makes a more spectacular basket than the macho fern does. So feed it every couple of weeks, and let's check in a month or so and see how it's looking.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate it.
Oh, always a pleasure, Janice. Thank you for the call.
All right. We've
got time to sneak Faye in here before the news break. Good morning, Faye.
Good morning. Bob, I'm having to rebuild my arsenal of products that keep everything going. And I need a little refresher after having a couple years of not doing very much gardening for various
uh-huh.
reasons. And one thing I might mention, there's that 1 acre property with nothing on it but just whatever grows there next to us. And it's
mm-hmm.
amazing how I've walked across it many times, and that the summer just wiped out. It looked like it would never grow again. It almost
uh-huh.
looked like desert-like. And you wouldn't believe how beautiful it is.
That's yeah. what a little rain will do for you, and a little temperature's not up in that 110-degree range. Last summer was about the most brutal summer that I remember, and I've lived in Texas many, many years, but nature does have a way of restoring itself, and we've gone from having the most miserable summer to one of the most beautiful springs ever, so I'm not totally surprised.
Well, it's so interesting, but would you help me? Like I say, build that arsenal of products. I think about Medina and others, but could you just kind of run through a little list of things I want to have back?
Well, I will happily do that, and then we'll probably put you on hold and talk a little after the news break. But you need a good dry fertilizer, and you need a good liquid fertilizer. The dry fertilizer can be Medina's Growing Green is excellent. Maestro makes one called Texas Tea that is excellent. Nature's Creation makes a couple of different ones. One they call their premium lawn and garden food is alfalfa based, and then one they have called turf food, which is manure based. And those are all good biosolids free dry fertilizers that you don't put on too often. In addition, I would have a liquid fertilizer, and my two favorites are the Medina Has to Grow products, usually Has to Grow Plant, and the Medina Liquid Fish Blend. And that's about all you need in fertilizers. Now, I love the little product called Super Thrive, that anything that's in trouble or anything you want to use as sort of a root stimulator, despite the hokey packaging, Super Thrive is a really good product to have. And Faye, let's put you back on hold and come back after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, I think there is one line left there if you want to grab it. We're going to talk a little more to Faye, and then Rafael, and then Debbie. right now. Let's get back and talk to Faye just a few couple of minutes more. So that ought to have your nutritional needs for your garden plants and, you know, everything else in good shape. Other things that I would suggest, diatomaceous earth is, you know, totally non-toxic and abrasive material that can be used for controlling a lot of different hard shell things like fire ants and fleas and such as that. I also put it out in the summer months because I live in an old house and my screen doors don't always close real tightly. I'll put it like along the door sill so that it deters scorpions and kissing bugs and things like that that might want to come in. So DE should be there. I think product that is called Sluggo Plus, S-L-U-G-G-O, Sluggo Plus. That is a product that's good to have on hand to control snails and slugs and pill bugs. Those are three culprits in the garden that are easily controlled with. It's a bait, of course, and once again, all the ingredients are totally safe for people and pets. And then the final thing that I would say is a must-have is some spinosad soap. I find that that will control everything from aphids to mealybugs to whitefly. You can always get spinosad and the insecticidal soap separately, but nowadays you can get it already, you know, mixed together, and you can get it in a ready-to-spray. You can get it in a concentrate. You can get it in what they call ready-to-use, which is a little hand sprayer. And that's what I would, you know, I would consider sort of the core group of products that every gardener should have available. and I guess I would add some orange oil to that. Orange oil is so useful for so many different purposes. I just get a bottle of Medina's orange oil and have that. And most all of those things have a fairly long shelf life. If you want to go one step further, a product that contains BT, the Bacillus thuringiensis, is great for caterpillars. A product that contains BTI, Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis, that is used to control mosquito larvae and fungus gnats, but I'm not going to put that on the must-have list that we started with. So if you get those things, all of them have pretty long shelf life, you should be all set for the next year.
Well, that's great. A really good list. And Bob, one thing, it's two things actually, bulb care and then vinegar use.
Okay. Vinegar is, they're different kinds of vinegar. The vinegar that we use most in the garden is going to be relatively strong vinegar, either 9% or 20%, that we add a little orange oil, a little molasses, a little soap to, and we use that for weed control. Now, apple cider vinegar is one of the ingredients of Garrett juice, and it has a number of uses, but I typically just buy the Garrett juice itself. I don't mix my own. I think apple cider vinegar is a good thing for you to take and me to take periodically, but the vinegar that you might want is going to be the stronger one that, again, is mainly for weed control. That would be a good thing to have.
And then in terms of bulb care, I've got some to plant. It may be a little bit late, but I've got some for flowers, etc. What about bulbs and then the care of them when the season's over?
The timing is one of the most important thing, more important things with flowering bulbs. There are things like crinum lilies that are very definitely perennial that you plant once and you should have them for years and years to come. And then there are annual bulbs, which can include everything from caladiums, which are, of course, grown for their foliage, to gladiolus, which are beautiful flowering things for the summer months. There are lots of spring bulbs that you wouldn't really be planting this time of year. We tend to plant them in late fall, like narcissus and tulips and daffodils and hyacinths and things like that. But this time of year, the bulbs that you might be planting would be caladium bulbs for their colorful foliage, gladiolus bulbs for their flowers. The crinums, there are a large number of crinums, and just be sure you have room for them because most of them make fairly large plants. And they're just an excellent thing to have in the garden, and they will be there for many years to come. You may want to experiment with things like the hippiastrums, what we call amaryllis, which you can grow as a garden plant. Here in the hill country, we're just too cold in the winter months, but close to Houston, you could probably consider those a plant for the yard. But those are the main bulbs that come to mind. Now, there's some things with tuberous roots, like cannas, that some people call bulbs that really aren't. And then there are the bulbs that make big foliage plants like your elephant ears, both the colocasias and the alocasias. But as far as flowering bulbs, those are the ones you're most likely to be concerned with at this time of year.
With the cannas and the elephant ears, we should be able to dig them up for the cold months? Or
You don't have to, especially if you're growing the colocasias, the round bulbs. Golly, I should grow those in Dallas, and we had much colder winters there than we do, you know, in the hill country even. And those and the cannas, super hardy. Where you are, both of those should be perennial 99 years out of 100.
Well, thank you, Bob, for all this good information and in a nice, tight package this morning. Thank you.
Well, Faye, it's my pleasure. You get out and have a great weekend, and I know we'll talk again. Thank you.
Yes, thanks.
Certainly. Rafael is next in line. Good morning, sir.
Hello, Bob. How are you?
Off to a good start. It's going to be a beautiful Saturday out there.
That is great. Listen, that's my usual perennial call for you. I have some bougainvillea pot plants that I, most of them survived the winter because instead of putting them in the greenhouse this year, I put them in the garage. Okay?
Okay.
I took them all out about 3-4 weeks ago and trimmed them and everything. Most of them have the deep green leaves now, and they're blooming, of course. Two of them are, the leaves are still yellow, and they are, some of the leaves curl up and turn brown around the edges. Are they sick or something?
Some bougainvilleas are just a little bit wimpier than others when it comes to growing well. And some of them are a little more sensitive to cold, and they may have gotten a little bit colder than or they suffer from the cold a little bit more than some of your varieties did. I would feed them regularly, has to grow plant or something like that. I'd probably add a little azomite to the soil, just sprinkle it on the surface of the soil. As it gets hotter, they'll turn around. They'll get dark green, they'll bloom, but actually, some of the prettiest ones are some of those ones that tend toward that chlorotic look early, and some dieback on the leaves. But give them fertilizer and sunshine, and they will respond.
Okay. I was just worried that they won't have gotten ill
somehow. No, they're going to be fine. They're going to be fine.
Okay, well. Bob, thank you again so much, and I'm sorry to bother you once a year, but
A bother, Rafael. You call me as many times as you have questions, and I'll always be here for you. I appreciate the call. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you so much, and say hello to everybody over there.
You just did. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Very good. All right, hang on just a second, Debbie. You will be up next, but let's get a quick break in here. I get to talk to you about Nature's Creation products, and great company. It's just they make a lot of good things. They package a lot of good things. They didn't give me a specific item to talk about, but I know they've really been interested in talking about their 20% vinegar, which is a great product used, they call it total weed control because it works so well, and if you add a little bit of orange oil to it, it works even better. It's totally safe for people and pets. Now, you know, don't splash it in your eyes or anything like that, but it's a very, very good product. They also package what they call a fungicidal cornmeal product, which is very good because now that it's getting warmer, starting to see a little more mildew, starting to see a little more black spot on the roses. This is just a good product. It controls fungi two ways. It has some garlic in it, which work to prevent fungi and works to prevent fungus. And then it has the cornmeal, which develops a trichoderma, which controls a lot of damaging fungi. Then, of course, they have all their bagged goods, the different kinds of soils, potting soil, garden soil, cactus and succulent soil, mulches and compost. Nature's Creation is a quality company bringing you quality products. They're sold by lots of fine nurseries. Golly, all the way over to Victoria, you'll find them at Earthworks, up in Fredericksburg, the Friendly Natives. Most all the feed supply companies around have them. Here in San Antonio, you'll find their products at Rainbow Gardens, at Milburger's, at Fanix, and of course we carry them here at Shades of Green. Quality products from Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and looks like next in line is Debbie. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning, Bob. And good morning, Bob, and thanks for starting early for those of us that also do.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here for you. What's going on in your world today?
Well, I've now acquired a place where I'm going to have sun, so I was thinking of putting in some raised gardens and I wanted to get a little information from you about them. I was making some notes with the call you did a few minutes ago, but I was going to do the raised beds, and I wondered material-wise, I've seen some containers that are like alloy steel, metal, and rubber. Mm-hmm. I've also seen that wood rot, so I don't know that that was my option. So first I wondered what am I looking for the container itself?
Are you looking to actually make beds, or do you want to actually have them in a container like a pot or something like that?
My thought is for people who are aging and don't need to go all the way to the ground.
Okay.
I was thinking of raised beds.
Okay.
But it doesn't have to be one that's got the legs on it, if it's just one that's higher. And I've seen them where people get the taller ones, and that was going to be another one of my questions. I've seen that people don't fill them all the way up with dirt, that they put cardboard and they put some wood in there and shredded paper.
Yeah, no, that's a mistake. You know, that's a mistake. You know, plants, the more soil you have, the more root system a plant can grow, and the more roots it has, the better the plant is going to do. Putting other things in is just for people that don't want to spend the money to buy the soil and consequently don't have as good a garden to begin with. So I recommend, you know, filling the entire container with soil. And there, I guess one of the big considerations is do you want something that's functional or do you want something that looks pretty? And if functionality is what you're really looking for, one of the best things you can find are these plastic tubs that the feed stores sell molasses products in, lick feeders, I think they usually call them. And many, many places sell the container alone for $5 or something like that. Or sometimes if they get overstocked on them, they actually give them away. But I have a lot of listeners that the garden in the old molasses feed, you know, tubs, and that's very effective. Just drill some holes in the bottom, and like I say, for just a very few dollars, and some places actually give them away. Some people charge a dollar or two, or maybe, I don't think I pay over $5 for them. I think if you look around, you'll certainly find them for less. And I've seen people grow everything from tomatoes to peppers to eggplants to okra, squash, cucumbers, beans, just about anything you want to grow in a garden, you can grow in those as a container. Now, if you wanted something more attractive, you can use the metal containers, but if you get the galvanized ones, the zinc that they use in the galvanizing process can be hard on plant roots. And if you get steel, the steel can just rust out over time. So unless you want to buy expensive, good ceramic pots, I would just look for something like the old molasses tubs and garden in those. And that you get, like I say, you grow just about anything you want to that way.
Is that what they're called? I get them at the feed store, and they're called molasses tubs.
Yeah, the feed stores sell them because they have a cake. It's not a liquid product, but it's molasses mixed with a bunch of other things, and you know, ranchers feeding cattle and things like that tend to buy them in large numbers, and then there are a lot of those tubs left over. I think you'll find the feed stores frequently have the tubs alone. If not, I would, you know, look online or, you know, just ask around a feed store, and you can probably find someone that has plenty of the empty tubs to sell at a very low price.
Okay. And so if I put those, what do I put around the edges? Do I just set them on the grass, or should I put some kind of stuff down on the ground?
No, there's no reason at all to. I, you know, drill some holes in the bottom and then drill some holes in the side, you know, just above ground level, because eventually they can kind of seal against the ground. But no, you don't need to put anything under or around them unless you want to, you know, do something to make it a little bit more decorative.
Okay. And what am I planting in them? Or each one should have their own, like, tomatoes in one, peppers in one. You don't mix things in them.
That is totally up to you. They're big enough that you could probably put big tomato plants. You could probably put three to a container. Smaller varieties of tomatoes, you might actually put as many as five plants per container. In peppers, if you're growing little shishitos, you could probably put five plants per tub. If you're growing bigger jalapenos or serranos or things like that, three or four plants per tub. If you're growing bush zucchini or something like that, at least three plants per tub. If you're going to grow something that just trails over the side and down, like cantaloupes or melons or something like that, you can put half a dozen plants in there. It just comes down to what you want to grow. But no, a lot of people have, you know, raised bed gardens in those tubs and have for years. The tubs probably last for a minimum of 10 years for you. So they're a small investment, and your soil just keeps getting better year after year when you garden organically. So, getting started, you'll spend a little money on soil and plants, but in the future, it's, just a matter of getting a few new plants every year and a little bit of fertilizer.
Instead of buying some bags of soil, is there a place I can go and buy it bulk that's better than another to get it at?
Whereabouts do you live?
Canyon Lake, New Braunfels area.
Talk to Weston over at the plant house. He probably would be able to better direct you up in that area as to where you're going to find the best soil. I would either talk to, again, the plant house there in New Braunfels, or you might talk, there's a fella over in Bulverde that they deal in grass. It's called Thomas Stone and Landscape, and he may have a good soil mix for you, but Thomas Stone and Landscape is in Bulverde, which is, you know, pretty much not too far away from me, or else ask Weston or one of the good folks at the plant house there in New Braunfels, and they can almost certainly suggest a bulk source for you.
Okay, and I think you used to talk about Gardenville over like on Evans Road or somewhere there. I don't even know if they're there anymore because I don't always drive that road.
Since Malcolm and Delphine are, unfortunately, we've lost both of them, they're quality is just not what it once was, and they deal in a lot of biosolids product, which I really don't recommend for vegetable gardens or any use for that matter.
Say that before. So yeah. What am I putting in there, compost?
No, just a good garden soil.
Oh, okay.
You know, any of your material yards will have something that should be pretty high in compost, but there are a lot of things besides compost probably go into it. Could be granite sand, lava sand, could be core, could be just a number of different things in there to balance the soil.
Well, I really appreciate your time because I never heard of these tubs, and that will be something I'm going to be looking for. I was going to order some of those containers. So thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Short of that, you might check with one of the bigger landscape nurseries around, and they have something called a 30-gallon shrub that they buy trees and things in. And they're more expensive than the molasses tubs, and they're not quite as heavy duty. So start with the molasses tubs. If you have problems locating, call me back, and we'll try to help you find something else.
You're awesome. Thank you, and everybody have a good day. Bye. Hey,
thank you so much, and you have a good one too. Goodbye. All right, we'll take one more call, and before we take a break, and that would be Kim. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have blight. I guess it's blight on at least one of my tomatoes. And I put out the cornmeal before I planted, and I cut off all the leaves that were looked affected, and then sprayed it with 50% water, 50% hydrogen peroxide.
Okay.
But like a day or so later, it's just like, it's like getting worse. And I'm wondering what I could do at this point.
Soak some cornmeal in water. Put like in a gallon of water, put 4 or 5 tablespoons of cornmeal and soak it overnight. Use that as a foliar spray. And that the trichoderma that grows on the cornmeal in the water, that's what's going to do the job. If you want to add a little bit of liquid garlic to it, that will help control the early blight as well.
Okay.
We call it corn water tea. And some tomatoes are much more susceptible than others. In my garden, I've always found that the Roma tomatoes were much more susceptible. In fact, I rarely grow Romas for that reason. But some of them are definitely more blight resistant than others. But putting down the cornmeal on the soil before you plant is a good idea. But that liquid water, cornmeal soaked in water, that spray is what does probably better, the more good than anything else I've found. Now, some people like and use neem oil. Neem is a very safe product. It's made from a Brazilian tree. It has to be very fresh. Neem, unfortunately, only has a shelf life of about 6 months. But that's another product that you can use, which is both a fungicide and an insecticide all in one, a natural product, which is very, very safe. But if you try the neem, I always tell people, if you buy neem, you know, put a date on the container, because after about 6 months, you'll need to get a new container of it.
And when you say soak it overnight, so if I started it this morning, I could maybe spray it by this, you know, this evening?
By tomorrow morning for sure, by this evening probably.
Okay, so at least 8 hours?
Yeah, and up to okay. 2 days. After 2 days, it tends to start getting a little bit on the odoriferous side, shall we say, but a minimum of 8 hours, maximum of 48.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Anything else I can do for you, Kim?
That's it.
All right. You get out and have a good weekend. And James, you'll be up next, but I need to take a second here, and I get to kind of switch gears and talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. I love the company. You know, that's why I've just contracted with them to put a new roof on my barn. I know I talk to you all the time about roofs for residences and business, but my barn needed a new roof, so I talked to Danny Bowes, and the guys are getting ready to put a new roof on my very large barn, and I have so much confidence in them. They're just the best company out there. They put the roof on my home probably 20 years ago, and I've not called them with one single problem. They put the roof on Shades of Green a lot of years ago. They just do it right the first time. In fact, that's Danny's saying. He says, do it once, do it for life, because you shouldn't have to redo a roof if it's done properly. They use a lifetime quality metal. They use the best insulation in the world. In fact, they go way above what building standards are required. And they have roofs that, well, they're going to save you money on your utility bills. Normally, most insurance companies will give you a discount on your homeowner's insurance because they know they're not going to have to replace that roof. How many more reasons do you need? There's a wide choice of different looks. It's all the same Galvalume-type metal, which lasts forever, basically. But you can have standing seam. You can have roofs that look like shake shingles or slate. And you can have a lot of different colors. I have a red roof on my home, as a matter of fact. Check them out. If you're looking for the best roof in the industry, you want to talk to Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. And their number is 210-822-6868. That's 210-822-6868. And by the way, if you had some hail damage earlier, you've probably got a little bit of insurance money to spend. Spend it where you'll never have to worry about hail again. Spend it with Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. This is going to be James and Teresa and Carolyn. Good morning, James.
Morning, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm off to a good start. How about yourself?
I'm getting ready to get off to a good start, but I haven't got there yet.
Well, lucky you. It's just a beautiful morning out there this morning, and giving us a little chance of rain tonight. And boy, we sure need it. But we can all use a little bit more moisture. But the temperature is going to be good. You'll be out there in that hoop house working before you know it.
Yeah, these winds are really drying everything out.
It's and it has been windy the past few days, but I don't know. It took a little trip headed over East Texas way, and man, it's, you drive over there and water standing in the fields and everything is just brilliant green, and you think, why don't those rains come see us? But they will one of these days.
Oh, that's good news. My Japanese persimmon really set a lot of little persimmons this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure I'm going to have to thin quite a few of them and put the bags on them. But when would be a good time to get that done? When they get a little bit bigger? Or?
I would let them get up to about marble size, because those persimmons, a lot of times, they set a lot of fruit, and then they drop a bunch of it a lot of the time. And so I'd let them, if you let them get up to marble size, then probably you can tell which ones are going to drop off. And you don't really have to worry about protecting them from the birds until they get up, you know, to their almost full size, because the birds don't seem to like them when they're little. But I'd say the size of a big marble, maximum size of a ping pong ball, but go ahead and thin them as soon as you can do that, because that means you'll just have the ones that are left on the tree will just get bigger and juicier and tastier.
What about every 3 or 4 inches apart?
I would say that'd be about right. Although persimmons don't cluster quite as close together as peaches do just on their own. But, I'd give them a good 3 or 4 inches apart.
Oh, some of these branches on the ends, they've got persimmons 1.5, 2 inches apart. Really set.
That's amazing. Do you know which varieties?
It's a Fuyu.
Yeah, Fuyu is one of them.
I don't know what the other one is.
Yeah, Fuyu, Tamapan, Taninashi, those are all great producers. They're super long-lived trees, and they're overlooked by a lot of gardeners. You know, peaches and plums get the headlines, so to speak, but they're going to live for 10 or 15 years. That persimmon's probably going to live for 50 or 100 years for you. They're about as hardy as pear trees, so they're just slow growing. I think that's what turns a lot of people off, but once they're up and producing, you've got a lot of years of good eating to come.
You wouldn't happen to know the leaf roller that we get on those, would you? It rolls the edge of the leaf, and then when you peel it back, there's a little green larva in there.
Yeah, it's a little caterpillar, and I do know the trichogramma will control those just like they do most of the others, but golly, James, there are so many caterpillars out there. Leaf roller is about all I would know to call it. I'm not an entomologist. My brain doesn't have room for the names of all the beetles and all the caterpillars. But put out those trichogramma like you do for your pecans and other things, and should keep those to a minimum.
I can't get any from Arbico Organics. I don't know what's wrong, but no. There's no deliveries, and they don't know when they're going to have any more deliveries of the trichos. So I'm putting out the green lace wings.
Mm-hmm. Well, the lace wings, they'll get. I love the lace wings against aphids and things like that. But look around a little further. In fact, you can call over here after we open and ask Wendy or Donna or whoever. We might be able to give you a name, because up to this point, we haven't had any trouble getting them. We get them from the same company that took over the Hydro Gardens business, and so far we've had good luck getting them, so they're out there.
Oh, okay. I think I have that number. I haven't tried them yet.
Yeah, give them a try. And if worse comes to worse, you might just have to drive into San Antonio and let us help you with some of them. But no, give them a try. I think they can put you in touch with people that will have them for you.
Okay. Well, thanks for the information on the persimmons. I sure appreciate your help and your knowledge.
Well, I appreciate your calls, and you share a lot with us. What's have you got your tomatoes out in the hoop houses now?
I'm eating my second red ripe tomato today. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I'm looking at it right now, so I got plans on it.
Well, you get out and enjoy, James, and I know we'll talk again, and we'll move along and talk to Teresa next. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Bob. I have a question.
Good morning.
I have a tree, Arizona ash, in the backyard, and it's already dead. I mean, it's half of it is already gone, and I did talk to you probably 5-6 months ago because it had like a, it was peeling like a black bark on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I took pictures, and I sent it to the gentleman you asked me to, and he said that it was diseased, that it was probably going to go. So we're going to probably get a cut, and we're going to try to do another tree there. But how far do we have to, because that tree, Arizona ash, is huge, and it was gave us a lot of shade.
Right.
But how big do you, how far can I plant the other tree or from the base?
Well, you don't want to plant right on top of the old ash tree stump because that's going to rot away. You know, ashes are soft wooded, and, you know, 5 to 7 years from now, you're going to have, in effect, a big hole there where that stump just rots away. So I'd move at least 5 feet away from it, but you don't, you know, there, you don't have to go any great distance. If you're far enough away that you can dig a good enough hole to plant a new tree, then the old stump's not going to cause you any problems, like I say, except that it's just going to rot away and leave a big cavity there, which ultimately you'll end up filling in with soil. But if you're, you know, 5 feet or more away from it, I think you'll be just fine. If you want a fast-growing tree that will give you a lot of shade in a hurry, look at Mexican sycamore. Mexican sycamore is probably the fastest-growing, reasonably good-quality shade tree I think you're going to find. And as a tree in a yard where you need a big tree, I think it's really good. They do take a little bit more water than some of the oaks do, but they're going to grow, you know, three times as quickly. If you decide you just want an oak tree, you want something that's going to live for 100 years, probably the fastest growing of the oak trees is what they call a Mexican live oak, or a Monterey oak is another name for it. It's in the white oak group, and therefore it's not worried about oak wilt or things like that. But the fastest growing oak, I would have to say, is probably going to be your Monterey oak. But if you just want a fast growing shade tree that's going to give you, you know, good quality and probably 50 years of life, then look for Mexican sycamore would be my choice.
Okay, and my other question is the pomegranate tree. I think I'm saying it correctly.
Pomegranate?
Yes.
Okay.
With the pink flowers, right?
They have an orange flower.
Okay. Half of the tree is dead, and half of this is growing. And I did the super strife, and it worked, but only half of it is growing. But all the limbs are growing on the bottom of it. Should I?
That's not a problem. Those are not normally grafted, so they're more often grown as a big bush than they are as a tree. So I just fertilize and water, let it come out and bloom and make pomegranates for you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. And I love getting my plants. My bell peppers are growing wonderful. My tomatoes are growing, and my serranos. And I even planted corn. They look beautiful. So I can't wait for the corn.
You're doing it right. And this has been Mother Nature's been pretty kind to us this spring so far. I just hope we can stay away from the hailstones that folks up north have been experiencing, and, you know, some of the really rough weather. But spring's been good for gardening. I hope it holds all the way through the summer for you. And you call me anytime you have questions, Teresa. Always here
all right,
for
thank you.
You. You're welcome. Thank you. All right, Carolyn, hang on just 1 second. Let's get a break in here, and I get to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center, and that would be a good place to go look for trees. You know, if you want to take advantage of that green tree shade rebate program, they keep changing the name, but it's something like that. You've only got a few more days because they cut it off at the end of this month. So it's a program where CPS Energy will give you $50 credit per tree if you plant, though, and they've got a long list of acceptable trees, including the ones I just mentioned, and they want you to plant them where they're going to cast some shade. But beyond that, what a great way to get a $50 credit. That'll pretty much pay for a 5-gallon tree, but it all ends next week. So get over to Fanix and see what all they have in stock. This weekend, they're giving 20% off all Landscaper's Pride products. Now, that includes mulches, compost. They have a lot of different kinds of mulch and decayed granite and things like that. They 20%, that's nothing to scoff at if you're looking for a bunch of mulch, and they have all types under that brand name, which is Landscaper's Pride. They've also just gotten in a new shipment of colorful annuals. They've got all sorts of perennials and roses. They've got the Traeger pellet grills and all the accessories. They've got the Ego lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment. Lots of reasons to get over and see Fanix. They're celebrating 85 years in business this year, and that's why they're putting some different products on sale. And this week's product, well, it's Landscaper's Pride today and tomorrow. Fanix is over on Home Green Road, right where they've been for all 85 of those years. Check them out online, too, at Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. My next three callers are going to be Carolyn and Ray and Elaine. Excuse me, Carolyn's first in line. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have one quick question. I have a small backyard chicken coop, and I use the pine shavings to, inside the coop. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if I can put them in the compost pile because it's full of chicken leftovers.
It would be excellent in the compost pile. It'll make some of the best compost you've ever had. And you can compost it like that if you like, or you can just use it as mulch in your beds as is. But either way, it's gonna make some of the best compost ever.
Okay, that was it. Thank you very much.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I appreciate the call. Thank you. And next in line is Ray. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Bob.
Got
a
good morning,
real
sir.
Quick question for you.
Okay.
Quick question. I need to for you to tell me what day-neutral bougainvilleas are. You mentioned them before on the air.
Yeah.
But when I ask about them, I just get a blank stare at other nurseries. I guess I got to go to Shades of Green, huh?
No, you can go to Rainbow or you can go to Fanix. There's some other good nurseries out there, but now all you're going to get is blank stares at Home Depot or HEB. But many plants, not all plants, but many plants pay attention to how long the day and the night are. That's why things like poinsettias, the reason they always bloom right at Christmas time, is they're what we call short day bloomers, same way with chrysanthemums. And many bougainvilleas are the same way. They produce best when the days are short and the nights are long. And that means that their varieties are really pretty in the spring, really pretty in the fall, but you just don't get a whole lot of flowers in the middle of the summer. A day-neutral plant, like a day-neutral bougainvillea, means that it doesn't pay any attention to how long or short the days are, that it pretty much blooms all the time. And those are the bougainvilleas that start blooming in the spring and don't stop until fall. They just continue to bloom very heavily all summer long. Probably, if you're looking for a red, the best variety to ask for is one called Juanita Hatton, H-A-T-T-E-N. Named for an old fellow named Hatton, still has a production facility over in Alabama. But Juanita Hatton is one of the best day-neutral varieties. There's a variegated one called Vicky that is day-neutral. In a good nursery. You should be getting mainly day-neutral varieties. There's another one called Flame. Can't keep up with all of them. But day-neutral simply means that it blooms any time. It doesn't pay any attention to day length. Whereas most of your older varieties, like Barbara Karst and Convent and those older varieties, they give you the best blooms in the spring and in the fall and not as many in the middle of the summer. That's why I like the day-neutral ones, because they just bloom all the time.
Okay, so Annex or your store, they ought to know exactly what I'm looking for, right?
Absolutely.
You do sell those, right?
Yeah. We do. Now, I'll tell you, bougainvillea has been a little bit in short supply. The growers are just, it's been so cool that, and I've been out of town for a few days, so I can't really tell you what's out there, but call before you come over, because just now starting to get numbers of bougainvilleas in, and I think, you know, 2-3 weeks from now, you're going to find lots and lots of bougainvilleas, but it's one plant the growers have just been slow getting out this year, so call around before you start driving.
Will do. Thanks for your help, Bob.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for the call this morning. Next in line is Elaine. Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. I put all my tomatoes into pots this year because ground is just not my friend out here in the sand this year.
Okay.
And I've got tomatoes that are 4 or 5 foot tall already.
Mm-hmm.
But they are yellowing from the bottom up. What do I need to add?
If it is, if it is just, if it's like a yellowing that is moving up the plant, it is probably a fungus disease called early blight.
Oh, I was hoping to avoid it being in pots. Okay.
Well, no, it can get in the soil, and then when we get rains, we've had some good rains, it just splashes out of the soil and up on the plants. Soak some of that cornmeal in water overnight and start spraying that. That will usually slow it down pretty well.
Okay, there's no way to get rid of it, though.
The best way is to prevent it, and normally by putting some cornmeal in the soil in the fall, putting it again in the spring, you'll head it off, but once it gets started, it's always going to be there at least to some extent. The other thing that will help prevent it is to make a garlic spray, and you can, make your own garlic juice, or you can buy it under the name of mosquito barrier or garlic barrier, and it works to prevent fungus of all sorts. Dr. Lane Ingham is the one that explained it to me years ago, and she said that there are only so many sites on a plant's leaf where fungus can get started, whether it's a tomato plant or anything else. And garlic stimulates so many different beneficial fungi that they kind of take up all the space and there's no room left for the bad guys to get started. So if early blight's been a problem in the past, start about the time you put your tomatoes out. Start spraying them every couple of weeks with a garlic solution, and that will also help a great deal to keep the early blight from ever getting established.
Okay, well, I put all new soil this year, brought in soil, everything was new. Because it's so prominent in my soil out here, apparently.
Yep.
Okay. Something else is happening. Now, I have another problem. It's not a problem. I have a friend who has a little bit, she has one of the tiny houses,
uh-huh.
And she needs something green to beside her steps. Unfortunately, she's in clay and muck in Cibolo.
Uh-huh.
It's just yucky soil. And there is grass where we're going to put this little bitty tiny flower bed for her. How do I go about prepping it for her? And then I've got a shady one and a sun bright one, and I need to know what to put in them.
And
they're like
is,
4 foot
is,
deep at the.
They're what size?
About 4 foot deep, and it'll be like it's between the porch and the house. So it's a semicircle type shape or a triangle.
And the grass that is there is St. Augustine or Bermuda?
Bermuda, of course.
Yeah. That's the tough thing, because Bermuda grass is just,
if it were
later in the summer, we could solarize it. Right now, I would spray with vinegar and orange oil mix, spray 3 or 4 times, water it, let it come out, kill it back, water it, spray 3 or 4 times, and you will get it under control. The main thing to add to the soil is going to be compost. You can take that old black gumbo material and add maybe, figure you're adding about one part compost for every three or four parts of the clay soil that you're working with, and you'll turn it into good soil almost immediately. I would add a little bit of dry fertilizer. I would probably add a little bit of azomite. And as far as plants, golly, there are lots and lots of choices. In the shade, easy things would be caladiums and coleus for pretty leaves. Probably begonias and impatiens, either New Guinea or standard, are going to be your best as far as flowers go. Over on the sunnier side, it's hard to beat periwinkles. It's warm enough now, and some of the new varieties. Look for some of the varieties called Cora, C-O-R-A, if you can find them, because they're the most disease-resistant and just bloom all summer long. You could also plant in those areas so many different things. You could plant salvias. You could plant, in fact, if you wanted to plant perennials, there are many different varieties of salvia that you could plant in the sun that would be there year after year. Skullcap is another pretty perennial that will grow out there, blackfoot daisy. But if you just want the biggest show, stick to things like your periwinkles. Are probably going to be one of the prettiest things. Pentas will do well. There's an upright growing annual called Angelonia, which is very brightly colored, and it would be beautiful in there. If you wanted to have kind of a common theme in both along with your flowers, you might plant a little bit of potato vine, the green, the black, or the variegated, and that would give you a real good ground cover in there that's very, very easy to take care of, and it doesn't mind. It'll grow in shade or sun.
And it doesn't mind Bermuda grass so much either. You know, I'm thinking she may just need to go to pots.
And that will work too. But I'll tell you what, if you go to pots, put something solid underneath, because I've seen that blasted Bermuda grass go right up through the hole in the bottom of a pot. But in effect, just put a plastic saucer or something down that you set the soil in. That'll help maintain the soil moisture as well. But that would be a good thing to start with, and then this summer when it gets hot, you could lift the pots out and solarize the area and be rid of the Bermuda grass, and then go back and plant however you like.
Okay, that's a good idea then. Thank you so much. I knew you'd have all our answers.
Well, it's my pleasure, Elaine. Get out and have a good weekend. We'll be back after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Have a couple of open lines. If you can get a busy signal, be a good time to dial right now. You know the number, 210-599-5555. My next two callers are going to be Julie and Danny. Julie is up first. Good morning, Julie.
Hi, how are you, Bob?
I'm off to a good start. It's going to be a beautiful Saturday out there.
It is as well here. I have two questions to ask. One might be easy and one, I don't know. We'll see. I have earwigs really, really bad this year, and I find it hard to use the DE. I mean, that works, mm-hmm. but then you can't water your plants.
Right.
I mean,
right.
you know, once you start watering, then that does that. Would... what would you suggest?
I would try spinosad soap.
Okay,
it's a natural
spinosad soap. Okay.
Yeah, that should control them.
Okay. All right. I will absolutely do that. I use spinosad soap a lot. So okay. The other
one of the best products they've come out with. It's so safe for people and pets and everything else, but it controls such a wide range of things that causes problems in the garden. So yeah, and it's so stable. I mean, it'll last as long as you don't get it too hot. It's got a shelf life of several years. So
it's
one of the best tools in the arsenal. Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay, I will absolutely do that. The other thing is we had some bare spots that started coming up. We lost four trees last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's drought, even though we water like mad. But anyway, we had them put some sod down. And on a couple of the spots that they were near some a couple of really beautiful trees, and they put the sod down, but I thought a little too close to the some of the trunks. Okay, now they just did it. They just did this on, you know, four days ago. So, and I'm not home, but we're going to go home Monday. And I was wondering, should I just take some big garden, whatever, and kind of start cutting that back from the trunks?
Well, the first of all, if the trees are high enough that you're actually seeing the root flare, you don't really have to worry much about grass. Now, you know, we don't want ivies. We don't even want ground cover. We don't want anything that's really going to interfere with the air circulation around the tree. So unless those trees need to have their root flares exposed already, the grass is not going to be that much of a problem. Now, I worry about being able to trim it without damaging the trunks. I wouldn't want it right up against the tree trunks, but it's not anything that's a real severe problem. Now, the grass hasn't put down many roots. In a week or 10 days, if it's been in 4 or 5 days, you can go in and just pick up those pieces of sod and, you know, chop them in half with a machete or whatever else. And I'm sure you can always find somewhere around the yard you could use a little bit more grass. But I personally, you know, prefer to have a bed or something around the base of the trees rather than grass all the way up to the trees. But that's just a matter of personal choice. It's not really a problem, but it's not the look I would like to have in my yard.
Mine either. But when they were putting it down, I didn't want to interrupt that. And just because I thought like just what you said, I'll just pull it up and kind of carve around it and make my own thing, because I just was holding my breath thinking, oh my gosh, are my other trees going to die because they laid this down? And I have a huge pine tree, and they were real they stayed way back from around the trunk of that one, and you know, and a couple of other ones, but a couple of them, they just put that stuff right up against the trunk, and I thought, no. But we were leaving, so I knew that when we'd be just to be gone 4 days, it wasn't going to make any difference. So
it's not going to affect the health of your trees. In fact, because you're going to have to water extra to get that grass established, the trees will probably appreciate that. But that's one of the things I'm going to talk with Howard Garrett about in a little while. We're seeing in the hill country, we are so much drier. When you look at that drought severity index and go from month to month, it's just like there's this red bullseye sitting over especially the hill country, a little bit San Antonio, but just month after month, the conditions are improving all around us, but we are so dry, and we're seeing big mature oak trees, pecan trees, elm trees dying from drought. And it's hard to believe that it's really that dry, because I know some of these trees are probably 100 years old, or just giving up as hot and dry as it's been for several years now. So unfortunately, it is a serious situation. You're not the only one that's facing it.
Yes, it is. It really is. And you know, we for 2 years we worked with this one. I think it was really a spruce type tree. Just, it was beautiful. I mean, the shape of it, everything. And I mean, about three years ago, it started, you know, one whole side would die and everything. And so we started the sick tree treatment like 2 summers ago, really.
Yep.
I mean, that poor thing had so much azomite on it, it probably thought, you know, it was raining azomite. But I'm telling you, it just, we looked out there about 3 weeks ago, and the whole half of the tree was gone. And I said, it's making me so sad. I said, just let's cut it down and do something else, you know, because it just wasn't coming back, Bob. It was just dying. And we were watering it like crazy.
I know. And there's just no way we can make up for, you know, for the rainfall. And when we're using city water, you know, we're dumping chlorine and things on it. And mulch is one thing that you'll never overdo around trees like that. And where it's practical, I'd want to mulch as far out from the trunk as you could go, up to 10 feet or so, with 3 or 4 inches of a good mulch, just to cool the soil as well as to help hold a little bit more moisture. But
I'm doing that with my other ones for sure. So and now two of them have a big old pile of grass across around them. So
That in and of itself is not gonna be a problem. But do get it moved and replanted as soon as you can, because you can't leave it stacked. And just the sooner you do it, the better. But rain dancer. Giving us good chances, but all the watering in the world isn't as good as a couple inches of good rainwater. And they're saying that we've got like 5 days in a row now with increased chances. So I just, whatever we can do, we need
That's
the rain
right.
badly for sure.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and you have a great weekend.
And you do the same. I appreciate the call. Okay. Thank you. Okay, goodbye. Danny is next in line. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Mr. Bob.
Good morning, sir.
Mr. Bob, we have a big tooth maple on our property. We live out here in Pipe Creek.
Yes, sir.
And I've noticed within the last month or so that it seems like the bark is peeling off the tree and it's kind of self-pruning a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a natural thing, or is the tree talking to me, telling me to do something?
How does a new growth on the tree look? How do the leaves look?
It just leafed out about a week ago, and the tree looks great. I mean, it looks like it always looks.
Mm-hmm. I, at this point, would not be really concerned about it. Again, that root flare needs to be exposed, but you know that. But splits up and down the bark sometimes are perfectly natural because that bark is kind of like a lizard or a snake. You know, that skin, their skin doesn't stretch, so periodically they shed their skin and, you know, have a new one underneath. In fact, in trees like pecan trees, the commercial growers will many times take a sharp, heavy-duty blade and it's cut. Just make a split up and down the bark on each side of the trees for about maybe the first 4 inches of the trunk, because it allows the trunk to grow a little bit more quickly in diameter. So sometimes some splits in the bark are just, you know, the sign of a good, healthy tree growing quickly. And like I say, as long as the root flare is exposed, as long as the new foliage looks good, as long as you're not seeing a lot of sapsucker damage or other things that would show that your tree is stressed, I wouldn't be concerned. Big tooth maple, where you are, as long as you've got it in some soil at least. I mean, Pipe Creek is kind of like my ranch. I've got places where I've got good soil, and I've got places where there is no soil. So I suspect you planted in one of the areas where you've got at least a reasonable amount of soil. And I at this point, I wouldn't be concerned. It doesn't really sound like a problem to me.
Oh, that's great. I'd hate to lose it. I had one more quick question about a tree. So I'm going to plant some crepe myrtles in our property.
Uh-huh.
And so just like you, I mean, I go down 2 inches and start hitting rock.
Sure.
So when I dig my hole, should I add in better soil or just use the soil that's available?
I would use, I don't like really doing a lot of soil improvement, because then your plant's roots just want to stay in the hole. They don't want to go into the native soil around it. But what I would very definitely think about doing is either berming it up or creating a bit of a raised bed. In Pipe Creek, one thing you've got plenty of is rock, and you could, it'd be real easy to create a sort of an elevated planter 12, 18 inches tall that you could backfill with good soil, plant your crepe myrtle. And, of course, most crepe myrtles that you buy are going to already be too deep in the pot. So begin by taking the soil back down to where you see the root flare beginning. But you can always berm up or create a raised bed to get it started. Now, you're going to need a lot of water to get it started, but there sure are a lot of good crepe myrtles out there. Just choose according to the size you want. Ultimately, you want a 35-foot tree, plant Basham's Party Pink. If you want a 4-foot tree, plant Pocomoke, or, you know, there are a lot of good dwarf varieties out. And then there's Dynamite, Red Rocket. There's so many different ones that are in that, 8 to 15-foot height. Just choose the color you like, but be sure you understand what the ultimate size is going to be, and don't plant one of the super tall ones under the power lines or right in front of the windows.
Okay, that's great advice. You know, talking about trees, like the previous caller, we actually have dead cedar trees in our property, I guess,
yep.
for the drought.
Yep.
I've never...
If we're the same way. My partner and I both are seeing dead cedars, and unfortunately, some of the more desirable cedar or desirable trees as well. Some of the cedars look dead and came back out, but there are a lot of them that are just totally dead from the drought, and that's a very unusual situation for sure.
Okay. Well, Mr. Bob, thank you so much for all your good advice.
Danny, it's always a pleasure. You get out and have a great weekend, and I know we'll talk again. All right, let's see. I guess we better get a break in. Some open lines. Grab one of them if you like. The number's 210-599-5555. Looks like I get to talk about Kinetico, and I love talking about Kinetico water softeners because if you're in the Hill Country, if you're in San Antonio, lots of South Texas, a water softener is just almost mandatory to protect your hot water heater, your ice maker, anything that uses water. You got a lot of calcium problems that can occur. There are two types of water softeners. The ones you hear spending all the money on advertising, the electronic ones, there's a little problem with them because they run on electricity, and that means a power surge could hurt them, a lightning strike could burn out the computer in them, and if the power goes out, you've got no soft water because they only work on electricity. That's why I love my Kinetico, which runs on the kinetic energy in the water. Electricity doesn't have anything to do with it. Your Kinetico is going to continue to function as long as there's water there. And it's so much more efficient. The electronic ones, they recharge on a preset schedule, and that way salt and water and money. The Kinetico only recharges when the rosin needs to be recharged, and that's going to save you money, and you're never going to run out of soft water because it's a twin-tank system. I love my Kinetico. I think you will love yours, too. They're so sure of it, they'll let you try it for 90 days if you like before you pay for it. If you're in the market for a water softener, get the last water softener you'll ever own. Call 656-PURE or go to KineticoSA.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, let's get back to gardening here. It is, it's just going to be a real nice day out there. A little cloudy, a little breezy, but that's a good thing. Let me see here who is going to be next in line. It looks like it's going to be Martha and Brad and Kenny. Martha's up first. Good morning, Martha.
Good morning.
Good morning.
One of my first jobs that my grandmother had me doing was pinching the tops out of the chrysanthemums.
Right.
I want to know, is that still what we do?
Well, and that's, you're... I guess you're showing your age because most gardeners, yeah, I saw a funniest quote the other day. It says, it's really kind of disturbing to realize that I'm the same age as old people. I'm just glad we're not old. But anyway, the reason for that is there are two ways to grow mums, chrysanthemums. One way is you do what is called disbudding, and you go up and down the stems, taking off all the little side buds so that one big bloom that's up on top gets about, five times as big, and that's how they get those great big flower chrysanthemums. Just the other way is, kind of pinch the top out of it because it makes it branch lower and you get more flowers, but smaller flowers. So the choice is really up to you. Chrysanthemums are going to bloom. They're going to branch some on their own. But if you want shorter stems and really big clusters of flowers, you pinch that top out before the plant really starts even forming a whole lot of blooms.
Okay. Thanks so much. And I found an agapantha.
Uh-huh.
At the grocery store.
Okay.
And how do I plant it? I just always wanted one, but never thought I'd get one.
Did it have a varietal name on it? Do you know what kind of agapanthus
it is? It
didn't
have a name on it.
Okay. Then let's get a little description of it. The leaves on it. Are they relatively narrow, like half to three quarters of an inch, or are they like an inch and a half or 2 inches wide?
they're very narrow.
Okay. Maybe that's good. That probably means you have one of the dwarf varieties. Don't know whether it's going to be, you know, a pink one like Peter Pan or one of the dwarf whites. There are bunches of different ones. But if it has narrow leaves, it's probably going to be a relatively compact plant, only going to get about a foot tall. The bloom spikes will be 18 to 24 inches tall. Compare that to standard agapanthus, where the plants can be 3 to 4 feet tall and the bloom spikes can be 6 or 8 feet tall. So that's why I was trying to determine a little bit about variety and what you have. But yours is most likely going to be a compact, bushy plant. Agapanthus like lots of sun. Believe it or not, they look delicate.
Not a problem.
But, yeah, the reason many people have trouble getting them to bloom is that they tend to baby them a bit and keep them in too much shade. I guess ideally if you had sun up until 2 o'clock and maybe a little bit of protection from just that blazing hot sun in the afternoon, that's probably where they would be happiest, at least on a grocery store bought plant. If they're nursery grown, if they're properly hardened off, they'll take all the sun that we get here in South Texas without a problem. So plant it where it gets at least a good strong half day of sun. Does it have blooms or buds on it at this point?
It has blooms, several blooms, okay. And they're blue.
Okay. Okay. Well, it's probably this variety called Peter Pan. Good variety. Fertilize it. It may give you another bloom spike or two, but agapanthus tend to be mainly late spring bloomers, and then you're just going to have a pretty foliage plant through the rest of the summer.
Right. Okay, let's see. What
I guess
else?
one more thing about agapanthus. Once you get a whole bed of agapanthus growing, which you ultimately will, they make great cut flowers. If you ever have so many bloom spikes that you want to enjoy a few of them inside, they'll last a week or 10 days in water. They're wonderful cut flowers. And if you decide that you want more, there are some new ones out there that are almost purple. They're so dark in color, and the white ones are beautiful as well. You can get a bunch of different colors in those dwarfer plants and have just a super pretty bed out there.
Oh, thank you. My two flower beds are in between the sidewalk and the house. So they're going to get really hot, and my Dusty Miller did great last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about using it as an edging. Is it because it's going to get all the heat from the sidewalk.
Okay. The problem may be that these plants probably came out of a greenhouse. They're probably a little bit tender. Long term, I think they will be fine there, but if you can, you may want to give them a little bit of shade while they're first getting started.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's always good talking to you. And
well, it's always a pleasure. And you enjoy your agapanthus.
I will.
We'll keep our fingers crossed. It's certainly starting off very nice. I was very concerned when we had those few super hot days back in February, but going into May, these daytime temperatures in the 70s and nighttime temperatures even in the upper 60s, so far so good. It wouldn't hurt my feelings if it stays that way all summer.
That's true. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Arthur. Thank you. Next in line is Brad. Good morning, Brad.
Well, good morning, Bob. Good morning, Bob. Two questions for you.
Yes, sir.
Not necessarily related. I will go to a convenience store periodically, and I notice that they have a lot of coffee grinds that they just toss out. And somebody mm-hmm. told me that coffee grinds are good soil conditioners. I know the big thing you always hear is that roses love coffee grinds. But are there plants that would be contraindicated to use that as a soil conditioner? Okay, so that's the first question. And the totally unrelated one is okay. Kind of in line with this previous caller. The northwest side of my house is shaded, and yet it gets very, very hot over there. It takes the bulk of the heat. We've got a brick wall and a small brick little pathway, mm-hmm. and I just have no luck getting anything to grow in an area that is very hot in the hottest time of the year, even though it's shaded also. So obviously it's going to be a plant, have to be a plant species or breed, whatever, that can deal with, you know, less sunlight, but also be, I guess, what, drought resistant and heat tolerant.
Okay.
So you can attack well, both of those, you know, if you could, please.
One, let's take them one at a time. Coffee grounds in moderation are a good thing. I mean, earthworms love coffee grounds, and a little bit of acidity never hurts anything. But believe it or not, the caffeine in there has shown to be a growth retardant and can stunt plants, as it were. So you don't want to overdo it with coffee grounds, but up to a reasonable point. I would never use them so thick that they're a mulch, but scattered through or blended in with the soil, I think a reasonable number of them are just fine. They grow a lot of beneficial fungi. The earthworms love them. So, in general, coffee grounds are a good thing used in moderation. Now, I don't know about the convenience store, but some places use lye, actually, in the decaffeinating process, and that is not good.
I make sure I don't get decaffeinated coffee at
okay.
all. Avoid those means, yeah.
And if you get grounds, most of the Starbucks stores give away grounds, and they use something called the Swiss water process for their decaffeination. And I'm a tea drinker, not a coffee drinker, so I don't worry about it too much, but all the coffee grounds from Starbucks are safe to use. But, again, just don't overdo it, or you can get some stunting in the plants. But beyond that, coffee grounds are definitely a good thing. And thrown in the compost pile, I think they're just fine. Let them break down a little bit. Let the caffeine be naturally diluted a bit, and then there should be no problems whatsoever. Now, heat-tolerant plants in the shade, do they get any sun at all? Do they get bright enough sun to cast a shadow?
Yeah, it's very limited. Maybe, I guess, 3 to 4 hours, you know, and that's earlier in the part of the morning when it's fairly cool. But, you know, I've got just the position of the house. It's a two-story home. The shadow there, and the house adjacent to us, of course, shadows a little bit. And then we have the fence and a wooden fence. So, it's just, you know, the worst possible situation for plants, I realize, is decreased sunlight and extreme heat.
Well, there are things that should take it okay. I wouldn't go out and plant 10 of any one thing, but I would experiment a bit and see what does well for you. How tall ultimately would you like these plants to grow?
Maybe 4 or 5 feet. I've got some lantana. And some Mexican bird of paradise that I put out, and it's like, you know, if you have a brown thumb, as I do, those plants are pretty well indestructible. I think the biggest threat to the plants I put out is male dog urine. But,
and that can be hard on things. But the problem with the Mexican bird of paradise and the others is that they need a lot of sun to flower well. Plant I would suggest to you is a plant called Compact Nandina.
Right. It's like a bamboo, right?
Well, the common name is heavenly bamboo, at least on the taller one. But, no, they are, believe it or not, a blooming plant that has white flowers and followed by red berries. But Compact Nandina is a super, super hardy plant that's going to get up in that 4-foot size, and it will grow well shade or sun, and the heat should be no problem whatsoever to it.
I actually put out one of those plants, but obviously I probably can get some more just to fill in some gaps there.
I think that would be a good choice. There is a green plant called Giant Liriope, or some people say Giant Liriope. Doesn't get quite that tall, but it will get up to probably 30 inches. It's very lush-looking, dark green leaves. It doesn't mind the heat, and that would be just the right amount of sun for it. So I would very definitely consider Giant Liriope a good possibility.
Liriope, okay. Yep. What was the other name for it?
Some people say Liriope. My grandfather said Liriope, so I've always said Liriope. It's spelled Liriope. And, The Compact Nandina, now the big Nandina is fine too, but it's going to grow 7 or 8 feet tall and get kind of bare-legged at the bottom. So the Compacta is one that will grow 4 to 5 feet that I think would be a good choice for you there. Other possibilities, you might try rosemary. Rosemary's
right.
Very heat tolerant, as long as you keep it watered. The upright rosemary will easily grow 4 feet tall. The trailing or spreading form will not get that big, but it should be, you know, quite tolerant of the heat, and half day sun should be fine for it. Those are a few of them that I would very definitely consider.
In the wintertime, of course, those would have to be covered up, I guess, like most other
only the Nandinas will probably go to 10 below zero. Giant liriope is good down into about 10 degrees. The rosemary should be good down to about 15 degrees. And so most winters, you're not going to have to cover them very much, if at all.
Well, I'm just hedging my bets if we get another snowpocalypse. I know the snowpocalypse was a gold mine for all the local nurserymen, at least from my standpoint.
The nurseries lost a lot of plants, too, and it was hard for us to restock. And I'll tell you one thing, if you just want some color out there, there is a form of, the common name of it is Wandering Jew, but most people call it Purple Heart, or its organic name
is
Set Gracia.
I've got some of that.
That would be a fun thing to plant low down around the base of your other plants. So it would give you some color, fill in nicely, and it doesn't care about the heat or the, you know, the sunlight would be perfect for that. And that's one plant that is just tough as nails and should do extremely well for you there.
I had that at a rental property, and you're right. It could probably survive a nuclear blast, the wandering Jew plant that you call it.
What it felt like last summer, didn't it?
Yes, no doubt. All right, well, I appreciate it. Got a lot of good advice here. Thank you, Bob.
My pleasure. I appreciate the call. All right, Don, let's get a break out of the way here, and we'll be back with more gardening.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got some open lines, so, not as many as I thought. Kenny and Jack and Ethan are going to be the next three callers. Kenny's up first. Good morning, Kenny.
Morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Hey, everybody calling you about keeping things alive. Well, I'm asking, how do we get rid of mesquite trees? We got the switch mesquites. We got a gun club there on Leon Creek.
Yeah.
And I guess the deer and the coyotes and everything is scattering the mesquite beans around.
Right. Do you have big mesquite trees, or is it mainly just the brushy, scrubby, thorny mess of mesquites?
Brushy, scrubby, the switch mesquite, what my dad used to call it.
Yeah, and it's the devil to get rid of. I was going to tell you, if you have any big mesquites, leave them, because they actually produce something from their roots that keeps the seeds from sprouting. That's why if you have a few big mesquites, you don't have those little ones coming up. An awful lot of ranchers made the mistake of cutting down their big mesquites, and so what they end up is with what you're fighting, which is that brushy stuff that is just a problem. It's one place that I resort to not staying totally organic. Whatever you do, don't go out and buy these products that, you know, like Remedy and the brush killers, things like that. Those will spread through the soil and kill a lot of things that you don't want to kill. I cut the mesquite off as low as I can to ground level. And then sometimes I'll just douse it with, you know, a cup or up to a quart of diesel. Diesel fuel kills mesquite. As a matter of fact, the products I don't recommend, they say add diesel to it to make it more effective. I think the diesel alone is, enough to kill it. And I always follow it up with molasses, either liquid or dry, because that stimulates the microbes that clean up. Most petroleum products actually break down pretty effectively into things that are not all that bad for the soil. Then, like I say, if there were a fully organic way to do it, I definitely would do it. But mesquite and weesach are two of them that just, you cut them down, they come back. You cut them down, they come back. You cut them down, they come back. I used to recommend mixing the diesel and molasses together, but it's just so hard. You know, they just separate so much that I've gotten to where I'll just douse that stump with the diesel, come back a few days later with the molasses, and that's worked for me in totally killing it and having it not come back.
Well, this is a big open field, so really we're not I mean, it wouldn't hurt if we killed a little bit of the, we got this, it's a grass like a mm-hmm. wheat stalk that grows in the summertime.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you can't hardly even mow that stuff. So
I know.
If we got rid of some of that, I mean, we keep mowing the mesquites down.
Yeah.
But it seems like they come back just bushier and bushier the next year.
And that's on most of my ranch, that's what I do. It's just spring and fall, I'll just go over it with my riding mower, and that keeps them under control, but it sure doesn't kill them. On some of the bigger ones that are in an area that I just want to have them totally gone, that's where I'll take a little bit more extreme measures. But don't go with any of the really toxic weed killers, because they're just they're bad news for everything around. It's amazing how far. I know they used some of them out at USA a few years ago, and then they called me and wanted to know why the oak trees were dying 200 feet away. And so
really?
We
have some nice oak trees on the perimeter.
Yeah. Well, don't let anybody talk you into Remedy or any of the other really toxic herbicides. But if you can, just keep mowing them down. If you can, you can solarize in the summer months, and that will help stop them. But mesquite is just one of the toughest trees out there to control, and that's what I've done to control them. And so far, it's worked pretty well, although it's an ongoing process, because, like you say, the animals eat the beans, and then the beans go right through, whether it's a cow or a deer or whatever else, and it's nothing we're ever going to be totally rid of, unfortunately.
Yeah, horses were used to be the worst. I used to work on a ranch whenever I was younger, and we'd let them into the house pasture, and next year you'd have mesquite trees growing everywhere.
And if you get them when they're tiny, grub and hoe, you'll get rid of them, and they won't come back. But, boy, after a year, they've got those roots down deep enough, they'll come back over and over.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Bob.
My pleasure. We'll talk again. And next in line is Jack. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I've got a question about what to do with my soil.
Okay.
I live about 15 miles due east of Lavernia.
Mm-hmm.
I have pure sand. My neighbor put in a pool. They dug down 15 feet, pure sand all the way down.
Yes, sir.
I'm attempting to grow grass. So far, what I've got is 98% pure wheat.
Oh, well.
What can I do to improve the quality of the soil?
Well, number one thing is build organic material. The more organic material you get in the soil, the more it will hold moisture, the more it will hold on to the nutrients, and your grass putting its roots down will gradually improve that soil. Mother Nature's patient, and she does this over thousands of years. We don't want to wait that long, so I will tell you that if you will treat periodically with molasses, either liquid or dry, that really helps build the soil. If you, in limited areas, compost can simply be blended in the soil, like for a vegetable garden or a flower bed. That will help get your soil in good shape over time. Any of the products that are high in humates, Medina offers both liquid and dry humate products, and this will build the soil. Stay very strictly away from synthetic products, though. The synthetic fertilizers and things are the reason we have such a problem, because those things burn the organic material out of the soil, whereas the organic products build it up. So when you fertilize, be sure you're using a good organic product from Medina or Maestro Grower or Nature's Creation or wherever. Espoma makes some good organics too. And like I say, anything that increases microbial activity, and products like molasses are absolutely outstanding. And again, in limited areas, because you can't buy truckloads of it, but compost will help get you off to a good start with more organic material, and it just gets better over time, and you'll find you have to water less. Just stay away from the synthetic products, and you can turn that sand into good soil. Like I say, it might take nature 1,000 years, might take you 5 years, but products like the Medina Soil Activator, Medina Plus, those along with your molasses are probably the best things you can put out.
What variety of grass would be the best one to start?
Are you looking for a lawn grass?
I'm looking for something that looks close to a lawn grass.
Okay. Then you probably are not looking for many of the native grass blends. In all honesty, it's hard to beat Bermuda grass. It is most sun tolerant, most drought tolerant. I like the dwarfer varieties like TIFF, T-I-F-F. There's TIFF Green, TIFF Way, TIFF 419. That is a very good grass. The only problem with the dwarfer varieties is you can't do it from seed. It has to be planted from pieces of sod. But that's what they use on golf courses. That's what they use on driving ranges. You don't have to buy the fancy mower unless you want to turn it into a putting green. But it's going to be one of the most drought-tolerant, heat-tolerant grasses out there. There is a turf-type buffalo grass. You don't want the native buffalo grass. That's a great grass, but it's not going to look like a lawn. But there is a turf-type buffalo grass, which is also extremely drought-tolerant. It will brown out in the heat, but comes right back when we get any moisture. And if you want a St. Augustine, I don't recommend St. Augustine in big areas, but if you've got an area where you need it for kids or pets or things like that, one of the nicest things about St. Augustine is it doesn't have chiggers in it, and it has the longest green season of any grass. The only variety I'd consider is called Floritam. It was developed jointly by Texas A&M and the University of Florida. That's where the name comes from. But Floritam is our most sun-tolerant grass. There's a lot of it grown in coastal areas, and it will tolerate the sand extremely well. But you can't stop watering it. Once you have it growing, if you stop watering it, it'll die where the others will just brown out. So those are the grasses that I would look at. I would look at a TIFF-type Bermuda. I would look at the turf-type buffalo grass. And in a limited area, I consider Floritam St. Augustine.
Thank you very, very much, sir. I was going to start some of that, and I've been procrastinating, but it's time to get into it.
Well, don't try to do the whole area all at once. Start small and expand it as you have the time and the water to do so, and you call me anytime I can help.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir. All right, Don, I guess we better get a break in here, and we'll be back with a few more phone calls, and then Howard Garrett.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. We're going to talk to Ethan and then Elizabeth. That's probably going to take us up pretty close to news time, but let's get started and see. Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning, Bob. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Loud and clear.
Very good, very good. So I called a while back about some avocados that I had sprout after
right.
putting some kits in some seed and having forgot about them. And so you had recommended to keep it in the same container. And I did, and I'm glad I did, because they had substantial growth, and I added some casting. So my question is, I have two shoots, one's 21, 22 inches long, and uh-huh. the other one's about literally about half, about 10 to 11 inches or tall, I apologize. Healthy green. Are the leaves, I think I just answered my question, but I was going to ask if the leaves on the lower part of the shoots should remain or fall off, or not fall off, but not be there, because
You want as much foliage, you want as many leaves on the plants as you can possibly have, because that's the plant's source of energy. Fertilizer and all, that's just kind of raw material. The only source of energy is through the sun's energy, and only the green leaves are able to capture that energy and turn it into things that the plants can use to grow. Now, the avocados, the grocery store avocados, those are going to have to remain in containers unless you want to build a huge greenhouse over them. They're going to have to spend their life in containers. So you probably want to let it go ahead and make multiple sprouts coming up. You want it to be multi-trunk instead of really tree-like, because, like I say, it's gonna have to spend its whole life in a container unless you want to move to Brownsville, in which case you could put it out in the yard. But no, I would leave as much foliage as possible on there. Obviously, it's not a grafted tree, so just let it grow as a bush, and one of these days you'll get avocados from it.
That's I was kind of surprised by, because I put it in a wide, shallow pot as compared to what most people do, or a lot of people, from what I do, they do a kind of a you know, taller, narrower sometimes, and they do the toothpicks and all that stuff, which is respectable. I totally understand that. It's just so weird how these came about. But the two shoots, I'm hesitant to dig up the soil to check on it. But if I remember correctly, the two shoots were coming out of one pit. I had two different pits that had sprouted, and one of them no longer with us, we'll say. But the one that survived, the two shoots, if you will, I believe they're coming out of a single pit.
Well, and that's not unusual. If you lived in Southern California and you were going to plant this as a tree in your yard, I'd tell you to take one of them out because they're always going to be a little bit weak at the base. But you're going to grow it in a pot. You're going to grow it as a bush, not a tree. So I would just leave it alone and let it grow like it wants to. It should make a nice bushy little plant for you. It'll take a while for it to mature, but, if you're able to protect it from freezing weather, if you're able to give it plenty of sunshine, one of these days you should get some avocados from it.
Yeah, just the patience and the discipline on the avocados is what I'm learning, and basically what you recommended last time, and I'm glad I followed through because it's looking a lot better. Okay, so really quick, tannins, I'm sure you're familiar with them, tea, coffee, they bind to protein. This is in the human body, and there's an interesting correlation with plants. So tannins, coffee, perhaps tea, spent tea bags, stuff like that, they actually bind they lock nutrients in the soil, from what I understand, as well as bind to protein and make protein less bioactively available for nutrient absorption. I thought that was fascinating how because a lot of people ingest a lot of tannins. I cannot tell you the number of domains sweet tea that I've drank over my life. A lot. And, sometimes that's paired with protein, and that's kind of, two steps forward, one step back thing that I understand. It's just so interesting how they do the same thing
It is interesting, and my recipe for most things in life is all things in moderation, and I think that goes for plants, too. Ethan, I'm going to let you go because I want to get Elizabeth in here before the break. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I probably have too many questions to fit into the time you've got, so I'll try to move through them real quick.
Okay.
I've been trying to figure out, and the information is just not there, for storing seaweed and Garrett juice and Medina has to grow. Mm-hmm. Can I store those outside in my barn, or do they need a little cooler temperature.
You can use them. I would not want them to get above room temperature, so my barn stays pretty cool, but a storage shed or somewhere like that is probably not the best place to put them. You just have to judge by the heat. If it gets really hot out there, then they would do better in a utility room or somewhere like that where they're out of the way, but where the temperature doesn't get above 75 to 80 degrees.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see. I've got a raccoon problem. Lights and sirens and the fence doesn't slow them down at all, but I made some garlic pepper tea, and that seemed to work.
Mm-hmm.
But then I read that the garlic pepper tea is not so good for the beneficial insects either.
Well, most beneficials are not bothered by it, and you can buy a super hot oil. It's sold under the name of Kohl's, C-O-L-E-S, Kohl's Hot Oil. I get it at the Little Nature Store up in Bernie is one place that I know has it, and handle it carefully. But we use it, we actually pour it around where we have raccoons digging. You can use it pretty much anywhere you want to keep them away. I tell you what, call back right after our interview with Howard Garrett. We'll talk a little bit more in the last half hour. Right now it's news time on KTSA Radio, San Antonio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
But as you know, if you've been listening long, it don't bow right this second. This is the 30 minutes we take to visit with the Dirt Doctor, Mr. Howard Garrett from up in Dallas. We'll save a few more minutes at the end of the show for more phone calls. And, of course, we do this again tomorrow morning from 8 till 11. But right now, it's time for our weekly visit. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning, everybody. Sorry, we're hogging all the rain up here.
Oh, man, I wish you would release some of it and send it down this way. It's amazing. Roberta and I were looking on our own ranches and various places around, and we're seeing mature trees dying of the drought. We're seeing oaks. We're seeing elms. I know some of these trees are probably 100 years old, trees that are 10, 12, 18 inches in diameter are just given up after, you know, several years of drought, and then had that 110-degree weather last summer, and it's getting serious. It is serious.
I didn't realize it had gotten that bad. We've had just an amazingly well-spaced-out series of rain events, and we got, you know, more coming today and tomorrow, it looks like.
And they're giving us a chance. We took a little trip earlier this week over toward East Texas, and there's water standing in the fields. Trinity River looks like it's at flood stage and is just so green. But, you know, if you look at that, what they call the Palmer Drought Severity Index, month after month, there's just this little red extreme droughts area kind of centered over San Antonio and the Hill Country, and all the rest of Texas around there, it just seems to be getting good rains. And we just, a friend of mine calls it the Bernie split. He said the storms come toward us and then they just split and go around Bernie and keep going. But it's very definitely a serious situation. What do you recommend? I know we talk about landscape watering and things, but for mature trees, is there an effective way to watering? Or what would you tell your listeners in that situation?
Yeah, just lay the hose out on one side and let it flood for a day or longer, and then move it around. Just flooding the ground does most good. You know, you can tell by looking at our plants in general, the native stuff and the landscape too around here. Everything is such a green, lush color. It's unreal. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that's just the fact that the moisture level in the soil is as good as it has ever been.
Yeah.
So,
well, you're fortunate. I hope they're giving us a good chance for the next 4 or 5 days, but we're even seeing the ash junipers dying around here, and I don't shed many tears over those, but, you know, you look at a, you know, 15-inch caliper cedar elm that just is not coming out. And the same thing with some of the live oaks. Even pecans, now I have to say the pecans for the most part, the foliage is a little thinner, but I have not seen as many of them, you know, really, really look like they're in bad shape. But we hope it changes. I guess that's the only thing to say. But the disturbing thing is that these trees that we're seeing die, they made it through the drought of the 50s. They made it through some very, very severe times. And just hope that it didn't turn out to be as hot as it was last summer. I think that, in combination with the drought, has really taken a toll on things.
Yeah, I think that double whammy of the last three winters followed by that 110-degree summer, I think that dealt a lot of plants some blows. Even the trees that are still alive, some of them have dead parts in them here, but overall, we're back to good shape because we've had such nice rain. Had a chance of tornado yesterday. It did hit Omaha, I heard. Must have been really bad.
Yeah.
And I got a tip for the people that were looking for Trichogramma wasp, and I probably should have mentioned this before. The company that James mentioned that he was buying from, we used to work with them some, but Trichogramma wasp now, by far, who I recommend is Coonafin down in Eagle Pass. Have you dealt with them before?
It's been a while, but yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. They do a lot of beneficial insects, as I understand.
Well, they primarily specialize in trichogramma wasps and fly parasites. I think they maybe have some other things too, but it's primarily those two. And they do the trichogrammas a little bit different. You know how some people do the trichogrammas on little one-inch tabs? They do
right.
them on strips.
Uh-huh.
And so it's more cost-effective. In fact, I called them this morning just to see how their stock was, since I heard James say that somebody apparently was out of them. And they told me that something I didn't know. They actually supply other companies with trichogramma wasps. They sell direct, too. So that's just a tip for people, especially like James, that are buying them on a commercial level.
Well, I'm making a note right myself to keep them in mind and check it out, because I'm a big believer in trichogramma. I think that even the pecan growers, it used to be one of the worst about spray. I think most all the commercial pecan producers have found those to be so effective against even the nutcase bearers that's pretty much what they're doing. And as long as you put them out properly, as long as you don't put them out in the sun, as long as you protect them from the kind of marauding fire ants, there's just no negatives to them. They once or twice or even three times over the season, we recommend them probably the first application as early as January or early February to get those early caterpillars, and then about middle of March, early April for the nut case bearers. And this time of year, when the so-called webworms, the tent caterpillars, start showing up, they're so inexpensive. It's not a big problem. It just doesn't take that many of them to effectively protect your yard.
Now, I've been recommending trichogramma wasp and beneficial nematodes both for all gardeners, farmers, and ranchers at the first sign of new growth in the spring is when I tell people to do it. And I like, my organic fruit and pecan tree program of spraying garlic fits right in with what you were talking about this morning, too. Garlic or garlic pepper tea, either one.
Right.
You're not killing anything. It's part of my soft pest control program. I'm rewriting that right now. I looked it up on my website and I noticed that I hadn't explained it quite as well as I do now when I do my talks and all. So that's going to be the next column that we come out with, is my rewritten soft pest control program.
Well, garlic is just an amazing product and pretty good for you and me as well, but it's both, a repellent and it's a natural fungicide. Elaine Ingham explained when we took her course a long time ago that one of the things that garlic does is it stimulates so many beneficial fungi that there's just no room for the more damaging fungus problems to get started. So been a big fan of garlic for a long time. Plus, it's so easy to grow. You can use it in a lot of different ways, but I can't think of much of anything that is more surefire in the vegetable garden.
Well, I think plants that have a built-in pest issue, the tomatoes with the early blight and the other plants that tend to have the same things hitting over and over again, I would spray those plants. And pecan trees probably in that category, but anything that gets hit by aphids when you have that temporary stress of the weather changing, those are all candidates for not only spraying with garlic or garlic pepper tea, but putting dry granulated garlic on the ground and let the plant take it up through the roots. I think it's very effective to do that two-pronged approach.
And can you say roses? I mean, the roses are... And of course, with things like the thrips, garlic is truly a safe systemic. It actually gets into the sap of the plant, and I know of nothing that will, stop the thrips problem as well as, they do. We like beneficial nematodes to get the larval state of the thrips in the soil, but once they're up and about, it sure does work well. And they actually, some of these places, I don't know if Cunafin produces those, but there are some little thrips predators, but I'd rather head them off in the first place.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's garlic is interesting stuff, and I think one of the most interesting things, I've never had anybody tell me that using a lot of garlic around their food crops put the taste of garlic into the crop, into the fruit or the vegetable. It may happen, but I've never seen it myself, and I've never had anybody tell me that it did. But anyway, Kunafin is K-U-N-F-I-N, K-U-N-A-F-I-N, they're an eagle path. It's a German family, really interesting bunch down there, so that might be helpful to some of the people.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be helpful to a lot of people. How's the project coming? How are those beautiful circular beds coming along?
Frustratingly. The rains have knocked us sideways a little bit, and the contractor had some issues with a couple of projects. The beds are in. I had to get involved myself and go pick out transplants because a lot of the things that I had specified were not available. And so I had to make some substitutions, and I got the seed all located. The herbs were supposed to be in yesterday, and so everything is supposed to be planted next week. So irrigation hose bibs have gone in, so it's moving along. The most interesting thing that happened, though, I got a call from the owner, and he said, "Howard, we got people stealing our soil, and we need to go ahead and spread it." And I thought, well, stealing our soil, we don't have any soil out there. And I said, oh, we did a big Hugel compost pile. And somebody showed up with a front-end loader and was out digging up a part of it and hauling it off. And I told him that was what it was, and we weren't storing that. We were actually making compost. So now we're on we have a raised vigil for people coming in trying to steal our compost pile.
The world's full of all kinds. If you think you've heard it all and seen it all, and then somebody starts doing something like that, just doesn't make sense. I came across something interesting the other day that Roberta did, that I wondered if you have ever heard. Have you ever heard of flowform fountains, or the technology they call flowform? It's apparently something that they've used apparently a good deal in Europe and some other places, where they try to create water features that move the water in a figure eight pattern, is the best way I know of to describe it. And they're saying it doesn't actually, of course, change the water in any way, but something about doing that really increases the beneficial microbial content of the water. And Google it and look at it sometime. It would be, I'm not real sure exactly how they do it. The company, of course, has some fountains they would love to sell you, but apparently that they've used this on some fairly large-scale projects and feel like they've just gotten extremely good results with it. And I just wonder if that was anything you had heard about.
Well, I've heard of related things. I haven't heard of that exact term, but there are more than a few companies out there that sell energized water and devices that do things to water. Years ago, we actually put one in here at the house. It was an electrical device you put online into the plumbing of your house so that the water coming in went through the device, and it was supposed to somehow make the water better in all kinds of ways. There may or may not have been something to it, but I think it's along the same lines you're talking about there. There's probably something to that. I just don't know enough about it to recommend it one way or the other.
And that's the same way I feel. It's just interesting seeing some of these things. And, yeah, I remember when they were selling magnets to put on your pipes and magnets to put on your fuel system in your car because it made the gasoline better one way or another. And haven't heard much about that in the past few years, so I guess it didn't perform quite up to the promises. But
there's probably something to it, because as you and I mentioned from time to time, rainwater, because of the spinning of the raindrops and something about the physics there, creates a condition of the water that is far better to plants than the water out of the faucet. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And again, I go back. I used to think, from my old days in biology and chemistry, that a water molecule was basically one oxygen and two hydrogen atoms, and you know, a certain distance apart. I can't remember what that the angle was, but I thought that was a fixed thing. But apparently it's been demonstrated that under certain conditions, you can actually decrease that angle so the two hydrogen atoms are closer together, and that in effect makes the water, or helps the water, penetrate through membranes better and get into plants better. So there's definitely something that happens. The spin with the rainwater, anybody that questions it, you know, has obviously never grown some of the lilies, those little oxblood lilies, rhodophylla, and watch those things. You can water them every day of the summer and nothing happens, and you get one good rain shower and they jump up and bloom. Yeah. So there's definitely something different about rainwater, and they say that if you have a little lightning along with it, that tends to put even more into the rainwater and make it even better for plants. And I, you know, to see what it does with things like the rain lilies, there's something to it for sure.
Yeah, it makes the rain have a higher nitrogen level and changes the energy. It does some things that I don't think anybody totally understands, but there's absolutely something to it.
Well, I wish you'd send some of those thunderstorms down our way so we can have a little bit more experimental material out there. But, you know, water's interesting stuff. Couldn't live without it, and it's, you know, the source of all the life. And there were days when this planet was nothing but water and a metallic core. But it's interesting to see how it works. And that's one thing. I don't have to understand it to believe that it happens.
Yeah, you mentioned oxblood or lilies or rain lilies, and that reminds me. I promised my neighbor that I would dig up some of my oxblood lilies and give to her, and this is probably a pretty good time to do that while we got nice moisture in the ground and we're a ways away from them blooming again. They're cool little plants. I recommend them to anybody. I'm redesigning the entryways to a residential project right now, and we're doing a real naturalistic situation and adding a lot of fern and various perennials in there, and I'm putting oxblood lilies into that design, so it's going to be kind of fun to do.
One thing that you probably know, but caution people that there is a difference in the oxblood lily. The ones that you and I have in our gardens, the ones we grow here in Texas, reproduce freely, and where you have one bulb this year, you'll probably have three or four, and given a little time, they make that nice big clump, which you can divide and share at this time of the year. But there are companies selling lilies that look much the same, calling them oxblood lilies, and I think they're coming out of Peru or somewhere like that, and they have the same look to them. They have the same characteristic of blooming after the first rain, but they do not multiply. It's one bulb this year, one bulb next year, and one, you know, bulb perpetually. So tell people where possible to be sure that they are getting the Texas oxblood lily. Because, you know, once you've got those, the bed, as you know, just gets better and better and better. But people going out and buying the bulbs, or especially buying them online, you know, beware, what you're getting may not be what you're hoping for.
Yeah, I don't know how to be totally sure on that thought, but that's a good point. I need to pass that along to my listeners as well. That's a good point.
Well, and in digging them, the only thing to really be careful of is not to break that neck on them, the part coming up out of the bulb. But I don't know. I've got a pretty big bed of them. I may go do some digging around, and if I can come up with enough of them, that might be something we could offer some folks as a little incentive for joining the Organic Club of America. I'll try to do some digging in the next week or two and see what I can find.
That'd be great. That'd be super. One thing I'm kicking around as an idea right now, I wanted to run it by you. You know, we've had trouble getting this book that I've been working on for several years published, and it's tied up between the guy that was going to finance it and us. But I think I may put it on DirtDoctor.com, kind of one chapter at a time, or divide it up somehow, and get it on there, because some of this stuff would work pretty well, especially the identification chapters that identify diseases and insect problems and weeds and that sort of thing. You think that would maybe be helpful to people if I did that first before the actual book is published?
Well, people have a great thirst for knowledge, and goodness knows you've got a lot of good material, and I know you've improved it even since I've seen it. So I don't think you should do the whole book. I think that that might be a, you know, a good lead-in to encourage people to buy the book after you get it published, but to do, you know, two or three chapters and very clearly identify them as part of a larger work, which is to be available in the hopefully not too distant future. I think that would be a very popular thing, and I know a lot of people, including me, would take the time and the ink to download it and print it out just to have it. So I don't think I'd do it with any promise that this is going to be the entire book, because I sure would love to see it, you know, in paperback form or hardback form, whatever it takes. But it would be a good way to get some good material out there, and at the same time, I think perhaps increase future sales. I would, oh golly, just thinking with you on that, I'm not sure what the best way to do it would be, but it'd kind of be fun if you put on dirtdoctor.com to put out the table of contents as you see it right now, and kind of ask people to respond and say, what would you like to see if we were to put a portion of it, you know, out for you to read and enjoy on dirtdoctor.com, and kind of generate a little interest there and get some input from people as to what are the many topics you're covering, what they consider to be the most important.
Well, I appreciate your input on that. I just thought of that possibility yesterday. I will run it by everybody here, and I'll keep you posted on it. May or may not do something along those lines, but it's a possibility.
Well, it sounds like again, it's going to be such a good book when it comes out. I can't believe how much the publishing business has changed over the years, apparently. And I think, as you have suggested, there may be some powers to be that are kind of depressing it or suppressing it as best they can, because some of our friends in the non-organic industry, I think, are a little bit scared of the popularity of what we're doing these days. So who knows? I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but I just can't imagine how much trouble it's been to get this one published, especially given the popularity of the other books that you've done. And I know they've sold well, because we've sold a heck of a lot of them here at Shades of Green.
Well, we'll just keep on keeping on, you know. It's still the same situation at the universities, although the universities may be changing right now with what all's going on in the news. Kind of crazy, isn't it? But we still don't have any universities teaching the natural organic program. It's kind of hard to believe, but people ask me all the time why, you know, when they get into it and see how well it works, why more people, more landscape companies and more golf courses and more everybody doesn't use the organic techniques. And it's real simple. It is not taught at the university level. So it's not taught where it needs to get started.
Well, unfortunately, it's not taught at the university level, and it's not promoted at the local level. And obviously, we built a big following and a big business around smart people, and you've done the same, you know, with your radio shows and with dirtdoctor.com, but it still is a little puzzling, and all the problems that people are creating with the toxic stuff out there. It just, when you look at a company like Monsanto that can absorb billions and billions of dollars of losses and lawsuits, and you know, just out there still pushing the same old thing, figuring they're going to make enough money to pay off all the lawsuits from people whose lives they've harmed. It just doesn't make sense to me, but there are a lot of things out there that don't make sense. I just know that organics make sense, and I sure do enjoy every week when we get to visit about it a little bit.
Yeah, it's fun to do it. Well, I've got a blonde dog sitting here staring me down, trying to tell me that it is time for breakfast. So sorry.
Well, it's amazing that you mentioned that, because somebody just opened a door, and I've got a beautiful little golden blonde boy that just came running over to say good morning to me. So you take care of yours, and I'll take care of mine, and we'll look forward to doing this again next Saturday.
That was great. Those pictures you sent of your dog, that is one beautiful pup. So well, have according, fun and,
according to Roberta, it's her dog when he's behaving, and it's my dog when he's not behaving. So anyway, give them all a pet for me, Howard, and give the girls a hug, and I look forward to visiting next week. Thank you so much for everything, and send a little rain our way.
Will do. See
you. All right, sir. Thank you. Bye. Mr. Howard Garrett is the Dirt Doctor. Best website on the internet is dirtdoctor.com, and just a wealth of information out there. Howard's up in the Dallas area, of course, and but the information that he shares, the information you find on dirtdoctor.com, is very definitely applicable here in South Texas. Don, let's get a break out of the way here. We've got time for a few more phone calls, so dial that number, 599-5555, and we'll be back with more phone calls momentarily.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Saturday morning out there. Just a wonderful temperature, nice little breeze out there. It's going to be a great day for gardening, and so many things to do. Lots of vegetables you can still plant. The bedding plant selection is just getting better and better all the time. Some new varieties of Angelonia, Pentas are absolutely gorgeous, periwinkles, some colors you won't believe. Anyway, I sure hope you gardeners are planning to spend some part of this day outside, and then maybe we get a good rain tonight and really settle things in well. Well, I'm glad to see Elizabeth got back through, and then it will be Dolores, but we start with Elizabeth. Good morning again.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. Yeah, we can continue this conversation. I found the Kohl's hot oil. It's
very good.
There's a lot of ways to spell coal. It's C-O-L-E-S.
Yes, C-O-L-E-S.
It's, I think it's Kohl's Flaming Squirrel Seed Sauce. Yes, sound about right. So,
well,
anyway,
the one that I got, and like I say, I get it at a little nature store up in Burney, but it just says Kohl's Hot Oil or something like that. But you know, the one thing I will tell you about it is wash your hands carefully after you've put it out, or, you know, put it out however you're doing it, because you do not want to get it around your eyes or around any other sensitive tissues, I will promise you.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. Do you dilute it at all and just spray it in the perimeter around the garden, or do you spray your tomato plants with it? Or?
You can spray the plants with it. I definitely would dilute it, probably, you know, even as little as 3 or 4 tablespoons per gallon, maybe a tablespoon per quart. It would be a little much trying to use it straight, but again, spraying it, that's what we do. Probably maybe a couple of ounces in a watering can, because we've have problems where the squirrels and the raccoons both want to dig. Who knows what they're digging after, sometimes trying to dig under a building or something. And maybe that's the one good side of not having had a lot of rain. It tends to last for several weeks as far as repelling them from a given area.
Okay, well, that sure will help. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Next on the list of questions. Are you there? Elizabeth, I think you hit the off button. Well, let's go ahead and talk to Dolores, and then maybe Elizabeth will get back through again. She apparently knows the secret. Good morning, Dolores.
Good morning, Mr. Bob. How are you?
Off to a good start. It's going to be a wonderful day out there.
Right. It already is. I've already been out putzing around in my yard. Hey, guy, I've got a rock garden, rock bed, about 20 feet in diameter.
Okay.
And I want to put succulents and things like that out. It's in the full sun most all the day.
Mm-hmm.
I have a desert rose. Can it tolerate the hot sun all day?
If you want to put it in a pot and put it out there, it will tolerate a lot of sun. You know, it's The sun is, well, I don't know how, let me back up a little bit. The sun isn't actually what burns, but the sun heats the leaf to the point that a plant can burn. And bright sun is not going to bother a plant nearly as much at 85 degrees as it is at 110 degrees. I never use the word normal when I talk about weather, but I would say in a typical summer, I think your desert rose would be able to tolerate that really bright sunlight. But who knows? They're saying this may be an extremely hot summer. So I would keep that, well, and you have to keep a desert rose in a pot because it will not tolerate any cold whatsoever. But my suggestion would be just, you know, set your pots out in this area and watch them closely. Actually, feel the leaves. Go up and you know, cradle the leaf in your hand and feel how what the temperature of the leaf is. As long as the temperature of the leaf feels cool, there's no danger of burning. But when that leaf surface starts feeling really hot, that's telling you you better get it back in a little bit more shade.
Okay. Well, it is in a pot, and I have it on a skid. Whatever you call it.
Yeah, but don't even think about planting it in the ground. Now, in the ground, of course, you can plant, golly, we were just digging up and replanting some different varieties of sedum yesterday. There are a lot of different succulent plants, the graptophyllum or ghost plant, and then, of course, a large number of different aloes, some of them more cold-hardy than others, lots of agaves, the manfredas, and this unusual cross they've made, they're calling mangaves, which are very unusual plants, but absolutely beautiful. And a simple plant, bulbine, both the yellow form and the orange form, they love that hot sun. Red yucca is not actually a yucca. It's a plant called Hesperalo, but there are several different colors of it out there these days. You can find a lot of plants to totally fill up that 20-foot, you say 20 feet in diameter or 20, yeah, 20 feet in diameter. That gives you room for a lot of different things.
Oh, yeah, it's a nice-sized garden. It's the only place that has full sun all day long and nothing else will grow. No shade plants will grow there, so I wanted to put.
You might think about putting, you might think about putting either in pots or in the ground. Of course, things like Pride Barbados will take that extremely well. There are some compact Esperanzas out there, which will give you huge number of flowers all summer long on a compact plant. In addition to the succulents and cacti, there a number of different things that will be very happy there. Even some of the bougainvilleas. I especially like, although they're hard to find, this upright variety of bougainvillea called Torch, T-O-R-C-H, grows much more erect and really showy as it comes into flower. So I don't think you'll have any problem at all finding plenty of things that will look good in that bed.
Well, I particularly wanted to put that out there. Kind of, it would be under or close to a desert willow that would give it some shade if it needed it. So
yeah, and desert willow is a great plant, but it's never going to create a lot of shade. It's always one of those plants that always looks like it's about a third dead. And when you actually see it growing in West Texas, as I have, the plant half the time looks like it's about 80% dead, but it just keeps coming back year after year, and the blooms are absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, mine is so, it is beautiful. It does have a limb that hangs down, and I want to cut it off because it's going to drag the ground here before long. But how would I do that? And could you replant that?
No. You could try air layering it, but I doubt very much if you'd have any success with that. You could take some cuttings from it, and you would have a chance of rooting. I'm not sure. I know there are select varieties like Bubba that are propagated, with through cuttings, but I don't think you'd be able to root a big limb, but you could take some of the new growth. I would wait for it to mature. I'd probably try it in maybe June rather than in May, but certainly be worth trying if you've got some of it that needs to come off anyway.
Okay. Oh, I'll let you know. My sister Darla used to call you a lot, all the time, and she's had a stroke, but she does listen to you when she can. And if you would, say good morning to Darla.
Well, you just did, and I will wish Darla a very happy day and improved health. You know, there's nothing that will improve your spirits more than gardening, and if you can't get out and participate actively, there's still a lot of things you can do, and you be sure that window stays full of blooming plants for her. There's nothing to raise your spirits like that.
We have a porch garden for her set it up, and my daughter is helping take care of her, and she does her gardening, but she tells her how to do it.
Well, you give Darla my best wishes, and it's good to talk to you. Always get out and have a great day.
Thank you. You just did, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye. All right, Don, I guess we better get our last break of the show done, and we'll be back with more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to the phone lines. Elizabeth, that phone is giving problems this morning, but let's try to get another couple of questions in here.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Yeah, I'm sorry, we got cut off. Let's see, I've got a friend that has a pile of cedar chips. It's been sitting for about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a great resource for mulch for probably the trees and the vegetable garden.
Would be a great mulch. I would not work it into the soil, but as a mulch on the surface, that would be ideal. There's absolutely nothing harmful in there.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought maybe Howard Garrett had said, oh, no, use hardwood mulch.
It's, you know, you use what you have. Use local mulch, but hardwood or juniper is what it is truly is. It's a great mulch, and it certainly holds up better than a lot of other mulches do. But, no, a lot of people think that there's something in cedar that retards growth, but, no, the only thing about that keeps a cedar tree from having stuff underneath it is just the shade it creates. The chips will be just great as a mulch. You want to make them even better, mix a little bit of compost with them.
Thank you. Yeah, my work to. All righty. Well, I sure would like to plant a wild plum, Chickasaw plum, but I don't think they're easy to find.
They are a little hard to find. I tell you, keep listening, because I'm looking for one for a very good friend, and if we can find them, we'll make that information available, and hopefully we can. We have one grower that used to produce them, and I'm after him to do it again, so I'll let you know what we're able to accomplish.
Thank you so very much. Well, I'll let somebody else in.
Well, you get out and have a wonderful weekend, and we will visit again. Right now, let's go ahead. We've got Frank and Judy waiting. Let's see if we can get them in here before this hour ends. Good morning, Frank.
Yes, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have some shrubs that I would like to transplant. Is it too late? Right now, I have the Dwarf Yupon Hollies, Japanese Boxwoods, and Buffy Buford Hollies, Mountain Laurels, anything.
How big are they now, and how long have they been planted, Frank?
Okay, the ones that I really am interested more in is the Yupon Hollies. They're about 2 feet long. Yes. They've been there for a while. You know, it takes a while, but they're beautiful. But I put them too close together, and I could use them somewhere else.
Well, if you do it immediately, it would have been a lot better to do it back in January or February. But if it continues to stay cool, it will be okay. If it turns off suddenly hot, it will be much harder on them. So if it's something, if you just need to get them moved, get them, you know, into a different place, go ahead and do it. If you can put it off till fall, you'll have, you know, greatly increased chances that they will do well. It's just this crazy Texas weather. We're perfect right now for transplanting, but, you know, it doesn't mean it could be 100 degrees in 2 weeks from now.
That is so true. Okay. And no, just on those, they're just shrubs. Do they go real deep? Do you have to dig real deep or?
It all depends on the soil they are in. They are a woody plant. They do have you know, a substantial root system, but if they're in good soil, the roots will be concentrated around the base of a plant. Will need to get a root ball that's maybe 15 inches in diameter and maybe 12 inches deep, but they are certainly transplantable.
Okay. Okay. Well, that was my question, sir. Thank you so much. And yes, I'm going to wait. I don't want to ruin the chances, right?
Let's talk along about October, and I'll give you the complete details on how to be successful with it.
I will do that. You have a great day, sir.
You Bye-bye. Do the same, Frank. Thank you. Goodbye. All right, let's finish the show up today with Judy. Good morning, Judy.
Hey, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Yeah. About 2 weeks ago, I had compost put on my front and backyards.
Okay.
And it wasn't real, real heavy, but it's still kind of sitting there, mainly because my yard was in pretty bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
But now, and I've been diligent over the years of putting beneficial nematodes down. I haven't had to use any flea medication on my dog for about two or three years, but now
Excellent.
They're showing up. So my question is, the grass hasn't grown through the compost yet. Should I wait mm-hmm. to put beneficial nematodes down or?
No, go ahead and put your beneficial nematodes down.
Go ahead and do it.
Yeah, you're fine to do it now. If you feel like the compost is too thick in any area, you can always get out there with a soft rake, with a leaf rake or something like that, because you certainly, where you have grass, you don't want to smother it. Now, it's nothing wrong
right.
with having the compost deeper in bare areas, because that's going to help the grass spread into the area. But if you feel like it's just too deep, just get out there with the leaf rake and just, you know, gently move it around a bit. But no reason at all to wait on the nematodes. Water first, because as we always say, the nematodes swim, they don't
right.
walk. So they need some moisture to move in, but who knows, maybe we will be lucky for a change, get some good rainfall, and that would be the perfect time to put them out.
Well, I hope so. I stopped by the vet and got whatever the flea medicine is. The
Comfortis.
Comfortis.
Right.
So usually what I do when they have a flea is I give them that when I put down the beneficial nematodes, and then it just gets them all, you know, and then I don't have any trouble for a few more years. So,
it's always for me. For me, it seems like it's about 3 years. After about 3 years, you usually have to reapply. But, you know, the secret of it is that the individual nematode lives for about 90 days. And as long as they are finding fire ants or fleas or whatever to reproduce in, their numbers stay up. And as long as we're getting some moisture, their numbers stay up. And I think what happens is just sometime over a three-year period, we get into a severe drought, whatever. It's just not ideal for that population to stay healthy, and they tend to die out. And then we reinvigorate it and go for hopefully 3 or 4 more years. The kind of drought and heat we've had the past couple, I'm not surprised that we're seeing fleas show up, but we're seeing fleas. We saw a bunch of grub worms, so I think folks are pretty well advised to make at least one treatment with beneficial nematodes.
I put some down in October.
Yeah.
So, it lasts a lot longer. Oh, well, I'll stop by.
if you've got fleas, get them and get them out soon.
Yeah, I've only found like one or two, so, but they spread fast. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right. Well, we've got about 20 seconds till the end of the show. Martin Bombas up next, so be ready with your home improvement questions. We'll do gardening again tomorrow from 8 until 11. It's going to be a great day to get things done outside. Don't let your yard be drab. There are lots of pretty things to plant. I'll see you tomorrow right here on KTSA Radio here in beautiful San Antonio, Texas.